Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Come on, you didn't really expect them to stay mellow the whole set, did you? Same was recorded from the Universal Amphitheater in December of 2001 and 2003 by Westwood One Mobile, Biff Dawes engineer, assisted by Doug Field, Phil Kneebone, and Jay Resnick, the usual suspects hard at work as always. High Voltage is a presentation of Westwood One, written and reduced by Fred Lindgren, in studio production by Stephen Cosio. Executive Biff, my man, Norm Pattis. Hey, don't miss music's biggest night, Sunday, February 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on CBS TV. Email address, we got one. It's www.highvoltage@gmail.com. Remember, if you don't have anything nice to say, we love it even more. I'm Nick Carter. Peace out, bitches.
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Peter and Jolene, with you on WRIF. Our shoulders, Jolene Jordan joining me. I'm Peter Werby. This is the Night Call Show. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Jolene, you were off last week. Welcome back.
It was, thank you.
It seemed kind of lonely.
Yeah, I know. I've taken a couple of days off in the last couple of months, but I'm here to stay.
Yeah.
Just sometimes I got to go and play.
All right. That was not John Cougar Mellencamp, although it sure sounded like his Pink Houses song.
Sure did.
He sang Pink Houses tonight on the Barack Obama pre-inaugural
concert in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah. This was called Little Pink Slips for the GOP, and it's done by Cleveland musician Colin Dussault, D-U-S-S-A-U-L-T. And, can he do it? I mean, one of the things, the confidence that the American people, even a lot of Republicans, are showing in Barack Obama is absolutely astounding. The warmth that they're having towards him and his family. I don't know, even those of you who did not vote for Barack Obama or didn't support him, can you imagine what it'd be like to have John McCain and Sarah Palin in this position now?
Well, you know, I think some people can imagine John McCain, but maybe not Sarah Palin. And there are still those diehards that, like that Elizabeth Hasselbeck, and I'm being nice tonight, and not calling her what I usually call her, from The View. She's still like Sarah Palin. So there are the what is it, 22% who still approve of Bush, right?
Yeah. I wouldn't want to sit next to them on a bus.
Or anywhere, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean... Where do you have that approval rating thing there? It's
I do.
Oh, yeah.
I do. 73% disapproved of his performance over the course of the two terms, and only 22% said they approved. Let's see. There was 17% of those surveyed rated Bush's presidency very good or good. And, you know, when Clinton left office, his was, let's see, 59%. So G.W. Bush has 17%, good or very good. Clinton was 59%. His dad was 40%. 83% says it was average or poor. And I'm there, and I think I can safely speak for you as well.
As well, yeah. Dick Cheney's favorability rating in the new poll is 13%.
That is so yeah. bad. Now, well, we can laugh, but, you know, we've been crying for 8 long years.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel this sense of relief. I'm not quite there yet, but I have a feeling I'm going to lose it on Tuesday.
Well, one of the things that Barack Obama's been doing every time he talks is saying, trying to tamp down expectations.
Well, and I don't blame him, because it really, you know, would take anyone an immense amount of work and time and years and support of Congress and you name it to start weeding through the BS that has been laid upon the American people.
For so long.
Yes.
Yeah. And the Bush crime family, which should be prosecuted, by the way, and should be investigated and should be exposed. And the Democrats, well, I shouldn't say the Democrats. Some of the Democrats, in fact, want to do that. Barack Obama, I don't think feels that's a priority. Now, and there's been a real debate. Some people say, look, the crimes of the Bush regime were so egregious, such an attack on the Constitution, on statutory law, on decency, any number of on truth, that this has to be that it has to be punished, or the next time these gangsters get in power, and you know, I got to tell you, they probably will, because everything turns, right? They'll say, okay, let's get back with this unitary president thing. Let's say, yeah, we're not bound by the Constitution, we're not bound by international law, we're not bound by you know, the laws that have been passed by Congress or the decisions of the court. So I think it's very important that Congress and grand juries begin investigating what was done illegally, improperly, unconstitutionally, and what have you.
The question is, do you really think anything will happen? These guys never are held accountable.
Never.
Even when they half-ass try to hold them accountable, it's not even, you know, a drop in the hat.
And they're just, Bush just whining about you know, those last valedictorian speeches, you know, at the end. I did, you know, I kept America safe and all that. Well, he didn't keep America safe. Remember, he was the guy, pardon me, that initially said, I'm going to work 24-7, 24 days, this was his big joke, 24 days a month, 7 months a year. And he was off on vacation in August of 2001. He got a presidential daily briefing that said, Bin Laden prepared to strike in the United States.
He ignored it.
He ignored it.
And
right.
You know what he's done? I was thinking about this today. I mean, it didn't just dawn on me today, believe it, but just thinking of really what defines Bush is that he's created more anti-Americanism around the world than there ever was before, and he has made us look so bad in the eyes of the entire world.
Well, we should be singing Ding Dong, the Wicked Witch is Dead, or saying something like, hey, on the way out, Bush, don't let the door hit you in the ass.
Good mm-mm riddance.
Or sometimes we say, adios, MS.
Yeah. I mean, we are saying that.
Yeah. Now, let me put it this way. Bush, the Bush crime family has left, and I'm stealing that phrase from Mike Malloy.
He's a syndicated talk show host.
An old pal of ours.
We pal around with those types,
exactly. That we've been left with such a mess that everything that these people touch, it's like the reverse Midas touch. Everything that was gold, they turned to crap.
Yeah,
right?
Yep.
We got two wars, we got this economy, and is it even possible? I mean, there are some people that give these worst-case scenarios and say, we're not going to pull out of this.
Right, and what is it that we were saying recently, we were talking about some 70% of Americans admit that they're struggling?
Yeah.
Something's like, that number is outrageous. And, you know, I mean, it's a whole new class of people who are struggling now.
Now, Bush and company were unique in the last, 50 or 60, 70 years in terms of a presidency that was totally racket posing as a government and inept. I mean, they couldn't do anything right. And they were so filled with this arrogance that they could accomplish all these things that fell flat on their face all the time. But a lot of this, like particularly the predominance of the financial and banking sectors in the American economy, goes way back, goes 100 years, 150 years, maybe it goes back to the origins, that capitalism, rather than rotating around the daily work that people like all of you listening and Jolene and me that get paid and get spent, or small businesses that, or even big businesses that hire people to produce products and services, it has become all about finance capital. And so they are so key to the functioning of this system that now they have us over a barrel. We keep giving them hundreds of billions of dollars. We need more. Are you going to give us loans?
And they do need more.
Yeah, they do need more.
They need a lot more.
So this, I mean, Bush brought it to the apex of ruin. Or I don't know, maybe that's not the way you go. Maybe you don't have an apex of ruin.
The asshole.
Well, let's move on.
S.
Okay. Okay.
Hyphen hole.
Okay. All right. Good. Oh, I see.
Ooh, I was playing our little letter game.
That was my career.
No. I didn't say that word.
Okay. You can actually, I walked by a television tonight there.
You know you were sitting in front of
it. I wasn't. It was such a super desperate housewives. And this woman is in underwear.
Yeah.
And
so
she
scantily clad.
Scantily clad. And she says to the... to this handyman, what do you think of my ass?
Really?
Yeah, so that's on, like, ABC television.
Oh, yeah.
You just can't hook it up with
the H.
With the H word.
I said S.
I got it.
You know, like as in...
All right.
Okay.
313-298-WRIF. And by the way, if you want to email us for the bashful, or for those of you who... or the lines may be busy. Where did I just see a phone? Oh, there it is. Right. And there's some open lines. So, actually, what do we want to hear? Do you have this confidence in Barack Obama? Is it?
I don't have complete confidence. Are you talking to me, or are you talking to the listeners?
Everyone, but you could answer. Everybody is somebody.
The listeners, because this is a phone-in talk show.
Yes, right.
And
right.
We've already said what we think that is going to happen, really, in the main, right?
Yeah. Now, the point being is what has caused these disasters on every level, from war to financial collapse, is it too institutionalized to go beyond just sort of minor reforms? Does it really need a second revolution?
Yeah.
To eradicate finance capital, to have banks, just places where we keep our money.
Yeah.
You know, right. Rather than, we're going to loan you money for your mortgage, Mr. Werby. And then, so I called, this happened like years ago. We had a mortgage like years and years ago. And they said I said something about, I want to talk about my mortgage. And they said, oh, we don't have it anymore. We sold it to, let's make up a name, like, Joe Smith. I said, what? Is this some guy standing outside? Well, it's the name of a company. And so that was like in the 80s. So, that was like ancient history. But now what we know that all these mortgages, all these subprime mortgages were all bundled together. Plus they have all these insane financial instruments that create money out of nothing. It's not the wealth. Wealth gets created by what you and I do, what we produce, what services we give and all that. That's where the wealth comes from. Real wealth within capitalism. The fake wealth, the phony wealth, the wealth that does not exist, the bubble comes from finance capital. And we have to eliminate that. We don't need it. It's a death sentence for us.
You know, and that's a little large for me to grasp. What do you do? What is the alternative? I mean, you did kind of explain it, but what happens?
Well, hey, listen. I'm just a rock and roll DJ turned talk show host.
Yeah, we don't,
I know what's wrong.
We don't have PhDs in economics.
Yeah, and a lot of the PhDs in economics don't understand it as well. And a lot of the PhDs in economics say, oh, this is great, great, great. You know, we'll create money and wealth forever. It'll be Dow Jones 40,000, except now it's Dow Jones 8,200.
And who's wealthy? I mean, a very select, small percentage.
Yeah. But here, banks, and this is just what we were talking about from the New York Times, banks in need of even more bailout money, even before word came on Tuesday that Citigroup might split into pieces to shore up its finances, an unpleasant message was moving through Congress and President-elect Barack Obama's transition team. The banks need more taxpayer money. You ever have friends like that? Can you loan me $10?
Yeah.
Never mind. Then they come back to you and they say, could you loan me another $10? And you say, hey, wait a minute, you already owe me $10. I know, and I'll give it to you on Tuesday. Right?
Yeah.
And you go, well, okay. And then pretty soon you realize that they're never paying you back. And this is sort of what the banks are like. But, so we're winding up. We, and I use that advisedly, yeah. We taxpayers now are owning large, in fact, and we have the majority stock in some of these banks. Of course, we have all the, we own the toxic assets. The rich guys that got us into this, they own all the good assets.
And that's an actual term that they're using. Toxic asset. Assets is an actual working term.
God, listen to this guy's name. At the Palm Beach Ritz-Carlton last November, John C. Hope III, the chairman of Whitney National Bank in New Orleans, stood before a ballroom full of Wall Street analysts and explained how his bank intended to use its $300 million in federal bailout money, courtesy, folks, of you and me. Mr. Hope said, make more loans, and that's what they're supposed to do. They want to, quote, free up credit, right, so you get this thing moving again.
Mm-hmm.
Make more loans, Mr. Hope said. We're not going to change our business model or our credit policies to accommodate the needs of the public sector as they see it to have us make more loans. You fools. I'm just taking your money. I mean, why aren't these guys like being run out of town on a rail?
Well, maybe that will happen.
Get the feathers. Come on. Congress approved the $700 billion rescue plan with the idea that banks would help struggling borrowers and increase lending to stimulate the economy. And many lawmakers want to know how the first half of that money has been spent before approving the second half. Well, this is a couple. I think they already gave it to them. But many banks have received bailout money so far, are reluctant to lend, worrying that if new loans go bad, they'll be in worse shape if the economy deteriorates. So it's kind of this circle here. But, and then you've probably seen this. This is from a while ago. Tracking the bailout money is difficult. it's like, you know, what'd you do with the money I loaned you, man? My cousin had, those things. They always got these bizarre stories. In the meantime, things are, did you see what? In one day, 45,000 jobs were eliminated. Circuit City just. And what I've been saying week after week, what did you and I do to deserve this? We did nothing wrong. Some of us ran up big, high credit card debt, but that bubble, balloon, whatever, hasn't even come home yet. As all these people, the 45,000 people that just got laid off, and what percentage of them are maxed out on their credit card, they're not going to be able to make their payments.
That's right.
Yeah.
A lot of people are doing the settlement thing on their credit cards. You know, just saying that paying like 60% balance, because I don't know if you are struggling to pay your bills, you can do that and don't let them bully you. And you can get a smaller payment and make a settlement. And, you know, perhaps, you never know, maybe someone can loan you the money to pay that off and get that out of your hair.
Well,
I understand.
But what did any of us do? The guys upstairs, the real rich guys, the guys, John Hope III at the Ritz-Carlton, they're the ones that screwed everything up. You and I didn't. So why are we the ones why aren't we getting the $300 billion, the $500 billion? Why aren't the 50,000 New Yorkers who have been collecting unemployment checks for 11 months are going to stop receiving weekly payments this week? And
really?
Yeah. They're going to face the loss of that lifeline. The next step is welfare.
I mean, it's gone for good?
Well, unless there's... this is one of the things that Barack Obama... says that they're going to do is try to increase, and they've done that before in other recessions. They've extended unemployment.
Okay.
I was once, I don't know, maybe I was the greedy instead of the needy, 65 weeks on unemployment.
Peter, you're going to get some emails.
You know where I got fired from?
Where?
Take a guess. No, maybe you'll guess wrong.
Oh, WRIF.
WRIF.
Where we are right now.
But I came back.
Yeah. Well, didn't they line up around the block and protest?
What do you mean? Oh, no. That was another
guy. That was a different one.
Yeah,
okay. There's always some kind of protest surrounding you,
but
Peter.
But also the states are kind of going down the drain, so a number of them are going to raise the gasoline tax.
I did see that, and that is scary. And that includes this state, doesn't it?
Well, it says others, so I don't know. But this is what they call
15 cents a gallon. Yeah. There was one state talking. I think that might be my home state of Iowa. I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's called a regressive tax. There's progressive taxes, which means the more you make, the more you pay. And that's kind of down the drain in general. And a regressive tax is a flat tax. So all of us pay the same. So one of these bankers that got our money through this, this bailout, he's making still, $50 million a year or something like that. Or you're saying, oh, come on. Nobody is making that much money. Out of the palace into the ditch. Did that scare you? Sorry.
I didn't know it was coming. I got jumped out of my chair. All of a sudden, you blared the crocus.
Sorry. That's the name of the band, folks. Crocus with a K. Walt Disney Company's chief executive, Robert Iger, received a compensation package worth $51.1 million in fiscal 2008, up 85% from a year earlier.
Up 85%?
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy cow. I thought things were going in the other direction.
Well, for some people, anyways. So the progressive tax would mean he would wind up, if you had a really steep progressive tax like you should have in this country, he'd wind up with $6-7 million, not 50. Well, I don't know. He's got to pay tax on this, but you got all these deferred payments and their stock options and all that. They've gamed the system in a way that we never can. I mean, the lower you are in income, the more the exact percentage of the tax bracket you're in do you have to pay. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I could even say it again. And that would be a progressive tax, because if it made any sense, in this country, you wouldn't pay any taxes till like you made $50,000. So you had the first $50,000 should be, all of a sudden I forgot that word. What is it? The tax deduction.
Oh, okay.
Is
that
right?
Yeah.
Is that the word?
You don't pay anything up
so
to
you get
50
there.
Grand.
Yeah. 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 Maybe that's, I don't know. I got too much.
We need to say it in simpler terms.
I got too much on it. So a regressive tax means that if you are Robert Iger and make $51 million, get this, you don't even mention the other part, $51.1 million. The $1 million is $100,000, right? So he made $51,100,000. But he's making so much, you don't even, if that dropped out of his pocket, he might not even stop to pick it up.
Probably. It should be just like pennies.
Like $100,000. And someone maybe can grab the stats on this, but I think that that 85% of our population makes under $100,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. All right. So it means that if you're making $22,000 a year, you're also paying that 15 cents on a gasoline tax that they're talking about raising.
Uh-huh.
So there you go. All right. Did you see? No, you said you didn't see that inaugural concert.
No, I was busy preparing for the show, Peter.
quite incredible. Well, now that I have this flat screen, now that I've become a vidiot.
I know. This is the first time in the history of Peter and I together, which is going on something like 12 years or something, that you have had access to like a television show that I didn't. I couldn't believe
it. Well, it was on HBO, the cable package I have doesn't. That's not in it.
Yeah,
but
I don't have it.
Yeah, but they had access to it.
Right, right.
And it was fairly incredible. It was. I
would have liked to have seen Beyonce do the Etta James tune. Did you see that?
In the where?
She performed in, that's inauguration night. But she performed tonight, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. She sang, what's that song?
She's doing At Last for the First Dance Tuesday night.
Yeah, the song she sang was written by a lesbian. What the hell is it? God Bless America.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
All these songs, you've heard me say that before. All these songs are written by...
I don't know my history.
By, you know, by gays or commies or...
Yeah, that we're all singing.
Yeah, they sang a commie song, too. This Land is Your Land. That was written by...
Pete Seeger.
By Woody Guthrie. Pete Seeger, who's going to be in Detroit what's the date today?
It's the, 17th or 18th, something like that?
Let me see if I can get it here. Come on.
It's the 18th.
The 18th, so it's like the 25th
yeah.
or something at the Arab American Museum. He's going to be there for a panel. Pete Seeger is. And
he's also playing at the Ann Arbor Folk Festival.
That's why he's agreed to do this panel. But, you know, both he and Woody Guthrie were very sympathetic to the Communist Party, and Pete Seeger was banned from television from in the 50s.
And he's a sweet little old man now.
Yeah.
Not little,
he's a big guy.
Yeah.
Tall guy.
I called him to set up an interview with you.
Yeah, sure.
And his wife said, this was great. She goes, hold on a minute. He's in the back field. You know, he lives in the country somewhere
right,
downtown.
New York State.
I thought it was
no,
oh, okay.
New York State, up the Hudson.
Okay. And she goes, and I mean, literally like 20 minutes later, you could hear her put the phone down. It's probably one of these old rotary phones. She goes, hold on. 20 minutes later, here he comes, and he gets on the phone. Hello? You know, and I talked to him, and I said, we would like to book you. Well, I don't want. I'm just kind of an old man now. And I thought, I go, you know what? You're an old man who stands for a lot of things for a lot of us here
well,
in this country.
I interviewed him last year, and he said he didn't think he could do a whole 25 minutes. And I said, whatever you want to do, Pete. And of course, at the end, I mean, I actually had ran over how long the interview was supposed to be.
Did you have to cut some things out?
No, I just ran it long. And he sang a little and, you know, extemporaneously, a cappella and all that. But on tonight's performance, which was repeated a couple of times on HBO, and if you have HBO, it's on what the hell, I'll tell you. It's on 11 o'clock.
At 2 a.m.
No, it's on at 11, I believe. And you can see it on HBO, even if you don't have it on cable.
Very cool.
You can just go to...
And that thing will be rerun, so don't go anywhere.
Right. But he couldn't sing at all. I mean, he's like 89, and he was actually just sort of saying the words. But he had such enthusiasm.
But I'm not talking to you.
No, I know. I know. The inauguration celebrations are going to cost $150 million.
This is the most expensive inauguration, and I think that it was only, $55 million for the G.W. Bush one.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, Obama's camp has been hitting me up big time for dough. You know, and I'm thinking, why the hell are they still asking me for money? Well, now we know why.
Well, you can go to unitedforpeace.org, unitedforpeace.org. Oh, yeah, is anybody going? We were going to be going. Well, you know what?
I'm actually working on the air tomorrow, so I couldn't have gone anyway.
You know what? I think we made a mistake not going.
I don't think we made a mistake, Peter. I mean, this is, I don't know. It's going to be really crowded. Now, I am not opposed. I went and I protested the Bush's inauguration 4 years ago. It was freezing. There were a lot of people.
I did 8 years ago.
Yeah. But I think this is going to trump everything as far as crowds go. Okay. And, you know, and it's going to be cold. We're going to be in our... Wherever we are, in front of that big screen TV, wherever we are, and warm and toasty and cheering, and we'll have our little drinks, and it'll be lovely.
Well, people are peeling off. At one point, they said 4 to 5 million. Some of the estimates are down to 1.5 million.
See, maybe because of all of that.
Well, because, they thought there was going to be 10,000 chartered buses. Now it turns out like there's 5,000. Oh, there's going to be a lot of people.
Still a lot of people, yeah.
All routes to D.C. guarded for Obama inauguration.
Yeah, like all the bridges going in are closed down. Yeah. It's going to be a pain in the ass, I have to tell you.
My wife said, why would anybody want a job where the only way you can remain alive is to be surrounded by 42,000 cops and army troops.
You know, your wife has a lot of really good points. When she says something, she means it and it is well thought out. But I have to say, you know, everyone who's so worried, I mean, the racism is running rampant, and I for one am completely disgusted by it. I mean, people talking, I understand that they're there is a lot of racism still in this country. And I know there were those skinheads that got busted for perhaps...
You know what? I don't know if there is a lot of racism.
I hope not. I'd like to think, but, you know, from the way people are talking, and this is Republicans who I know, and I do know some, and we work with some people. And I was talking with one person that we work with yesterday.
Yeah.
And he started, in a half hour, he mentioned assassination three times in the form of three separate really bad jokes. And he said...
He could get arrested. I mean, like, for real.
Well, he's lucky I'm not a cop, because his ass would have been in jail. And he said, you know, I'm not getting you on any of these, Julian. Why are you laughing? I said, you know, because I'm offended. And I, you know what? And if he's listening right now, I'm still offended.
Let's drop a dime on him. I think you get rewarded. Yeah, that's an old-fashioned expression for calling the police. Let's drop it down. You know, I think you get rewards for this.
Well, he's not talking about himself doing it. It's just these really poor-taste jokes, and I just don't understand it.
We'll stretch it a little.
Yeah. I could use a break, that's for sure. Not me, but
anyway,
him.
There is still these people that don't get it, and I'll tell you, all politicians are suspect in my book, and I think the sort of confidence and the hope that people are placing in Barack Obama. I mean, as we said earlier, even he's saying, "Hey, come on, you know, this is a pretty tough and tight situation."
Yeah.
Watching tonight, and some of it, you know, I mean, I was just thinking what a McCain-Palin would have a deal would have been.
God, that would have been so boring.
All white and a couple of Negroes, you know, there.
Right, the token, right.
Yeah, they would have had the Blackwell, the guy that was I can't remember his name, Robert Blackwell, the Secretary of State who stole the election for Bush in 2004 in Ohio. I mean, maybe he'd be there and all that. But this was so wonderful. I mean, it was the rainbow. It was our country. And
I love that.
Yeah. And in that it has the kernel of real transformation, of real revolution, not even so much in the political realm and who knows.
In
the human realm,
right.
Yeah. I mean, we can get over this crap that's been haunting us for centuries almost.
Him coming into office, the racists are coming out of the woodwork and making jokes like this, right? And it really bothered me because so many white people that I run into are talking about that very fact. It's like, you know, can we talk about other things? Or
really? Why not? You know... I don't want to go where you go.
Leave this building.
Really, they were people I know, not people I know, people I know of. Their neighbors were having, I don't know what it was even. I'm trying to think of the phrase. Something like Bush goodbye parties.
Well, that's the thing. I was going to say, you know, just to get off this racism thing that is just so upsetting me, is that I think as much as it being come on in, Obama, we love you, blah, 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 worship, worship, worship. It's as much as goodbye, George W. Bush, and good riddance.
What was it? Good riddance to bad rubbish.
I like that one.
Tomorrow, if you actually want to take one of those steps, particularly for Euro-Americans, me and other people, I'm going to be down there. Being down there is downtown Detroit.
Yeah.
It's Central United Methodist Church.
Let's not forget tomorrow, MLK Day.
6th Annual Detroit Martin Luther King Jr. Day Rally and March. It's at noon at 23 East Adams, and it's at Woodward. So it's right down at Grand Circus Park.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at noon. There's going to be speakers. There's going to be a march and a rally. And it'll be the best of Detroit, the best of the Detroit area. You can be part of it, too.
I wish I could go.
And yeah, you're going to be on the air right then, aren't you? Yeah. Well, you can go to my website, Peter Werby, PeterWerbe.com, and you can go to my calendar page. It'll give you all the information. All right, let's take a break. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And thanks to so many of you that are on hold. We'll get to your calls right away when we come back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls
right after this. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Hello.
How are you?
It's Mike, and Friday morning we were watching the news reports on the big old airliner landing in the Hudson River when NBC's Brian Williams threw it to this reporter on the scene who was clueless. Listen close while the producers and directors in his ear screaming at him to go, 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 start talking, you idiot.
Mike Taibbi, among the first journalists responding to the story. He's in Lower Manhattan for us tonight. Mike, what's the latest?
So we would encourage a moderation.
Whoa.
Go, Mike. Go ahead. I know you. Go, Mike.
Mike Taibbi.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear anything except Chris. Well, all right. There's a pilot named Chesley Sullenberger who by tomorrow will be a folk hero.
Oh, my God. You've got to be kidding me. If we can hear it, why can't he hear it? Mm-hmm. I mean, go, Mike, what does he think that means?
There's something quite like coverage of live breaking news.
Isn't it great? Oh, it's fantastic.
It really is.
Yeah, that's when you want to watch a story, when it first breaks and everybody is trying to be the first one to get it on the air, and they'll interview anybody that comes along to say anything.
Tonight, Mike, what's the latest?
So we would encourage a moderation.
Mike Taibbi.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear anything except Chris. Well, all right. There's a pilot named Chesley Sullenberger who by tomorrow will be a folk hero in this country.
Mike in the morning on 101 WRIF.
Hey, Detroit. Chad Johnson here.
You more on the riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all. We said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
Riff 2. It's music made for the Motor City and totally commercial free. Log on from anywhere in the world at riff2.com. Everything that rocks.
That's it. I'm out of here.
You hear stories about people just putting their keys on the counter and walking away. Trouble is, even if the bank does sell your house, you still may be liable for the difference between the sale price and what you owe. That's right. You've lost your home, tanked your credit rating, and you may still have to pay the difference. That's where I come in. This is Mike Greiner from the Financial Law Group. As a former deputy mayor of Warren, I've seen how the depressed economy affects people's lives and livelihood. Before you call one of those 800 numbers, call me. I'll help you file for bankruptcy and get out from under your credit card debt. If you're in danger of losing your home, let's talk about your options. It's my job to help you resolve your legal issues in the simplest, most cost-effective way possible.
The Financial Law Group, 586-693-2000. Evening and weekend appointments available. Call 586-693-2000. The Financial Law Group, using the law to protect your financial future.
The Financial Law Group is a debt relief agency helping people file for bankruptcy relief under the bankruptcy laws.
Well, hi. Something didn't happen there. Let's see. Oh. Wait. This is worth it.
Peter and Julie, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, our numbers are 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. Peter Werby, Jolene Jordan with you.
Yeah, and I got an email from Alyssa who said, why is there no discussion about what Obama can do for the poor? It's always middle class. And we do talk a great deal about the poor on this show. I guess we just didn't do it tonight. So great point, Alyssa.
How about this one? Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. He emailed to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Peter and Jolene, Peter and Ms. Jordan, he says.
Why, thank you.
I have one big idea. Give the mammoth embassy in Baghdad to the United Nations. It will give the UN visibility in the Middle East. It turns out what is a gosh-awful Bush boondoggle and huge liability for us into a real asset. Yeah, $700 million, the world's largest embassy. We're never getting out of Iraq. Although, according to a senior advisor...
Starbucks there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Senior White House advisor David Axelrod said that that on the first day that Barack Obama will order the beginning of withdrawal of combat troops from Iraq, He also plans to close the prison at Guantanamo, but it may take
up to a year. Yeah. But he's doing that day one.
Yeah. God. All right. Wow. People have been waiting a long time. Man.
I know.
Yeah. Here's Mike in Birmingham. Mike, hi. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF, and you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Yeah, this may be just a rumor, but somebody told me that Jeb Bush is supposed to be running for president in 2012.
Well, there was an article recently in one of the big newspapers, one of the national newspapers, that Bushy number one said Daddy said he would love it if his son became president. So it could be just from that article alone that they're basing that upon. Let's hope.
Well, they got to have some hope. Yeah, maybe it would be Bush and Palin in 2012.
Oh, God.
That's scary.
Well, no, go ahead and do it because it ruined this thing for this campaign for McCain. Ruin it again. Bring the bitch back.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF. It's Ray in Detroit. Hi, Ray.
Hey, what's up, guys? Oh, my God. I listen to you guys, like, every Sunday.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, you guys are, like, awesome sometimes. But
sometimes, sometimes. All right.
I was listening, like, and you guys talking about the Bush approval rating and stuff. And well, I have to really say, you know, it's like it's been like the past three presidents, and I've been losing like a lot of money in my business, and it's just crazy.
What kind of business?
You know? Huh?
Ray, what kind of business?
Oh, I sell drugs.
I was going to say, what do you do? Sell drugs?
Yeah, it's like I'm only making like, what, $2,400 a week now, and it's horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. God.
What's happening? You would think, people just don't have enough money to buy your product?
No, it's more along the lines. It's just I'm used to having a bigger, you know, cash flow, and it's crazy.
Well,
stay high, buddy.
Yeah, stay high. Bye-bye.
It helps ease the pain.
Yes, right. Here's Mike in Riverview. Mike, hi. It's Peter and Jalene on WRF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing tonight?
Hey, Mike.
Before we get into anything, one thing I do want to say is, you know, Obama's election is a fantastic step in the direction for minorities.
Absolutely.
It is long overdue.
Yes.
But I'm really having a hard time stomaching some of the things I'm hearing from you tonight.
Like what?
Ooh.
Like what?
A constant attack on Bush and his attack on our constitutional rights.
Right.
When you're welcoming with open arms a president who openly opposes our Second Amendment rights.
Well, wait a minute.
No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't.
Well, wait a minute. You said openly. Well, how does he openly?
Yeah, what are you basing this upon?
Barack Obama's voting record in anything to arm civilians to protect themselves has been against it.
Well, you know, I actually don't remember the incident, but this was like about automatic weapons and stuff like that.
Like Uzis. Yeah. Do you need an Uzi?
Let me tell you this, Mike. I get this email, and there's this whole thing about
we get this about once, twice a month.
Yeah, this ammunition that's going to have to be marked. People, I mean, this is all this kind of hysteria around Second Amendment.
That's why the gun stores are so damn busy.
Yeah,
I don't know. They're packed.
People think that Obama is going to take people's guns away, so they're buying more. I don't get it.
Yeah, they're just storing them up, you know. And
if he's going to take them all, why did they? But anyway, Barack Obama is not going to do, nor the Democrats are going to do anything with
your concealed weapons,
with guns or any of that. What he has got to face right now is the whole problem of the economy, of these wars, of all this stuff.
He has bigger fish to fry.
Yeah. You're buying into this hysteria that these right wingers are trying to put down.
No, actually, I work at a gun range. I sell guns for a living.
And it's busy, isn't it?
Yeah, so
it's ridiculously busy because on November 5th, after Obama was elected into office, his stance on guns was very quiet throughout the entire election process.
Because it wasn't an issue. He doesn't have
a big, huge agenda on that.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, Mike, if you're a gun salesman,
I think you're too close to it. Yeah, and people are filling your head every day with this stuff.
Well, I don't think so. I think you're filling people's heads with hysteria in order to generate sales.
Or maybe you're all... Oh,
because
Peter.
The more the more that people are worried about this, the more money you'll make.
Guns.
The more arms we'll have. Everybody won't just have one gun. We'll have 20 guns apiece. That's a great idea. Great way to move.
I don't even have one.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. Bye. Man.
Don't worry about your guns. You're going to be fine.
Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, hey, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter and Jalene. How you doing?
Maurice.
Doing great. What's up?
You know, my question is this. You know, government, you know, don't have no money. This is an inauguration of costing up to wazoo. What's up with that?
Well, it is. It's not up our wazoo, fortunately. They have all the people that are footing the bill for this. In other words, not coming out of taxpayer money with that.
Right. Except it's donated money, right?
Yeah, there is some money for security in Washington. But, I mean, it is, you know, let me tell you this. I have to be honest with you. If this kind of extravaganza was taking place for McCain and Palin,
I'd be railing on him. I had that same thought when I read about those numbers. I would be going crazy.
Right.
So, look, we can admit we're human.
He
thought I was already going crazy. Oh, yeah, that was years ago.
All right, Maurice, thank you. Hey, we got some open lines for you on Night Call. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Here is Bill. Bill's in Warren. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter? How you doing, Jalene?
We're doing great.
How are you?
Good. Hey, I was listening to your show on my way home, and I heard you talking about printing money out of thin air.
Sure.
And I believe in that. I believe we're going to have a scenario in the U.S. that's going to be like down in Mexico when they had the collapse of the peso.
That could be. That's one of the worst-case scenarios. You're right.
When they went down to zero, mm-hmm. and you were talking about somebody having a cure to try and get out of that, you know, money out of thin air and all this debt and all this finance these banks are practicing in. Well, what they do now is that Federal Reserve, the evil empire, which is run by Rothschilds and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what they end up doing is printing bonds. The government prints bonds and trades that for money, which is printed by the Federal Reserve, which is not a government agency.
Well,
a lot
right.
of people.
But China, and then China buys it up, for instance.
Exactly. I think, personally, that $700 billion that they were talking about releasing to the banks, that mm-hmm. was China calling a market rate, as quiet as it's kept.
Well,
so, I mean, I'm a little right-wing about a lot of that, but I just believe there's a lot of...
Well, careful, though, about this Rothschild stuff. I mean, that takes you in directions you really don't want to go and doesn't... I mean, the Rothschilds don't have anything to do with the Federal Reserve System.
Somewhat.
No, none. Zero.
Well, Bernanke, Greenspan, and, you know, all those characters, they seem to pull a lot of strings to influence world banking.
Well, that's who, you know, the people that run things have turned it over to. All right. Thank you very much, Bill. Appreciate it. Here's Eric in Livonia. Eric, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing good. Great.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, with the whole racist thing that Julian's bringing up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just, you know, settle down. You know, then, you know, settle down. It's just,
No.
I can't. I wasn't in your situation, you know.
Yeah,
but,
well, it was really offensive, and this guy is telling, like, these racist jokes. And you know what? I got to tell you, dude, I have zero tolerance for that stuff.
Well, also, did you know one thing? In fact, somebody made the point on CNN today, probably Wolf Blitzer, that idiot. But he was saying that Barack Obama never says very little about, has very little direct racial identification himself.
The only thing that he said was he's going to get, as the White House dog, he's going to get a mutt like him.
Yeah, I mean, he's biracial. If you really thought about it in any realistic terms, he's no more black than he is white, since he's 50-50 like that. But in a racist society, you have this deal: if you have one drop of blood, you know, you're all black. But that's the way the cookie has been crumbling for the last several hundred years. And I think that it's important as a cultural trend that we move away from that. And seeing those, I don't know how many of you saw either the HBO special or saw any of it on the news, it was really heartening to see these choruses with mixed black and white people and Asian people and the different entertainers, and that it all looked like a society that we want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if it's not yet.
And you know what, Peter, did you read Frank Rich in the New York Times today?
Thank you, Eric.
What's that?
I said, thank you, Eric.
Oh, thank you, Eric. Okay, I'll try to chill out a little bit, but I doubt it's going to happen. I thought it was really poignant. He said, as a white guy, he really has no clue how, you know, deeply this is affecting the African American population in this country. And it's true. You and I could never really probably grasp that. But I'll tell you what, I have a whole lot of emotions of my own.
Sure. And
involving
it. As a white man, I have, a hundred times more identification with Barack Obama than I do with John McCain.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's
and
nothing
I come from the Norwegian Republican background. I'm as white as they get, baby.
Yeah. And you know, you can be happy for people. No, nothing's being done at us white people's expense, whatever the hell
right.
that means. It's just a little bit of insanity that some people still maintain, and the kind of pride that people have, particularly of groups that have been in a minority.
Right. And that finally skin color didn't stop someone from gaining the top office in this country. Yeah. I'm amazed and quite pleased.
Well, I have to say that had the same set of circumstances accrued to a different candidate that was a white candidate for the Democrats and could have still created the enthusiasm,
yeah,
probably would have gotten another 10 million votes. There could have been millions of people that that voted, ignorant beyond any imaginable depth.
And there is a whole lot of ignorance out there.
Ignant. Ignant, indeed. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And here's John in E-Course. Hi, John. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Totally awesome. Love the show.
Thank you.
Thank
good.
You.
Why did you guys cut me off earlier? I wasn't done talking.
Oh, no. You were already on?
You were not.
Yeah. You came, was really
raged. You
oh,
came,
my God. Like, I was, like, really going to talk and stuff, and you guys, like, cut me off.
You came on under you came back on under a different name?
Well, I go by John, too.
Well, I'll tell you, John.
He pulled the oldest trick in call-in,
radio. Let me tell you one of the unfortunate things about talk radio. The host absolutely controls how long the caller is on.
And by the way, Peter's the one pressing
I'm
the buttons.
Yeah.
I'm over here hands-free.
And I have to make a decision what makes for good radio. And very frequently people get cut off. In fact, I've often thought about telling screeners that they should tell callers that Peter may end the call without saying goodbye.
Hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Don't tell Al because he's on a rare occasion actually screening the phone calls, but for our phone screener, we should do that.
Yeah, and people often feel that they didn't get a chance to respond, they were misunderstood because they were cut off too quickly and all of that. That's talk radio. I'm sorry. All right, John, I got to cut you loose. Thank you. You can't come back on. Another time, please. Let's see, here's Eric in Waterford. Eric, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd just like to say that I think you cut off the guy who was talking about guns a little early, and you didn't really respect what he had to say.
Call number two in a row, Peter.
Yeah, what, he got his point out.
Do you think you can make the point for him, the rest of it?
No, I don't think I'm educated enough on this
subject. Do you think Obama's going to take away your gun?
I don't know how exactly.
Okay.
But what sort of disturbed me about the call that here's a guy that's there's this hysteria among certain segments of the gun-owning population. I mean, there's tens of millions, like 100, there's like 200 million guns in this country. So it's really located in a fairly small circle of people that are always fearful that their guns are going to be taken away. And it's mostly generated by the right wing, even if these people aren't particularly right wing themselves. And it's to make people forget all about all the other issues, that so-and-so is going to take away your guns, you know, or so-and-so is going to, you know, have to register, you're going to have to register your ammunition and what have you. Well, this isn't happening with Barack Obama. It's not on the agenda. It's not an issue that would be fairly divisive and would be a diversion from what he has to deal with, particularly the economy and these damn wars that the Bush crime family left us with. Well, so it's bad enough that people are, have those kind of crazy concerns to begin with. But then we found out the guy's a gun dealer, and he is benefiting directly from the hysteria that's created around it. Well, I figure.
You sit back and enjoy it.
Bye-bye.
Right. What's he complaining about? He's making money.
Yeah. Right.
I don't have anything against Barack Obama, but to say that the gun concentration is in a small group of people, there are a million hunters in Michigan.
Peter, I think you need to.
Almost everybody I know owns a gun.
Well, maybe I don't know how I could say this clearly other than to repeat it. I said there are 200 million guns in this country, which means millions and millions of gun owners, and I said that the hysteria revolves only around a very small segment
of
gun owners.
The hysteria. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And that's who is whipped up by these gun nuts in the NRA and what have you. Guys at the top leadership that are these far right-wing conservative Republicans. Leftovers from the last administration, the people that have screwed up everything and got us in the mess that we are. But it's like I told this John that tried to come back on, Eric, I got to make the decision about how long people are going to be on the air. And what can I say? 98% of people listening do not call.
Yeah, it's a small percentage. But,
We welcome you all.
Try to make it, if you want to really get your point out on the air all across the Detroit, the Metro Detroit listening area.
Worldwide.
If you want to get it on, really get it on, have it kind of thought out before you come on the air. It helps.
Yeah, the big word, succinct. Get it, get it right down.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. And in fact, Eric, I want to go to our next caller real quickly, and he's going to speak to this. This is Tim from Lincoln Park, and he wants to talk about the Obama gun rumor. Tim, hi. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene.
I don't know if I can be succinct, but the whole thing about Barack Obama is going to take away our guns is absolutely false.
Okay.
And I'll cite the Supreme Court case in 2008, the summer. There was a case, and it came out of D.C., and it boiled down to the constitutional question of whether the Second Amendment applies to individual gun ownership or collective gun ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And the court decided squarely, at least to the point of view of most lawyers, that all individuals, given limitations on mental illness or whatever, can own guns. And Barack Obama supported that decision.
Okay.
A decision I didn't support. Actually, the court now has finally decided that if you're, a U.S. citizen and you haven't committed any crimes, you can, own pretty much any sorts of weapons you want.
Sure.
So and Barack Obama agreed with that. So this conspiracy that he wants to take away our guns, I mean, there's no evidence for it.
Well, it's one of those sort of blogospheres, email hysterias that, like I said, works to the benefit of the far right wing. It's a diversion from the real problems we have. It's generated by the right wing. And, I got an email just from somebody who I like a lot and have a lot of respect for that sent this thing about that Barack Obama is going to introduce legislation that we all ammunition would have to be registered and it would cost you $2.50 more. Some states are considering stuff like that, but that's up to state governments. Barack Obama's not going to do it. But thanks for that, Tim. Good. I needed that information. Thank you. Oh, here, actually, we read Tom in St. Paul's email. Now he's calling in. Tom, hey, you're on the air. Go ahead. I got to go. I got a minute or two for you. Go ahead, and I got to do my top of the hour break.
Oh, hello. I'm on the air now?
You're on the air now, Tom. Hi.
Okay, well, I also agree. Barack Obama's a constitutional law professor, and he's a student of politics. He isn't going to jump into that can of worms.
No, absolutely not.
That I think is the best point of the night when it comes to this.
Right.
But I think what Barack Obama needs to do is get pushed, and what I sent you was a good idea, I think, and that if you could get this idea out, then people could look at him and say, well, why not do this idea?
This is the idea to give the...
And the idea was to give away the embassy that Bush paid all kinds of Halliburton idiots to build.
In Baghdad.
$700 million.
And we don't even use it. We're trying to run the Iraq by... as a puppet government through it, it's not a true embassy.
Hey, you can get a chai latte there.
We're not going there to
negotiate with them, you know, at an arm's length deal. You know, it's a little army base.
Right. Well, it cost us, the taxpayers, $700 million for the Baghdad embassy, the largest in the world, the largest in the history of the world.
And yet we're going to pull out of there? What the hell did they build that for?
It'll be like houses. You know, we'll sell it to the UN for $400 million or something like that.
No. We destroyed the whole stinking country. We owe Iraq big time.
Yeah. True.
And this is a small down payment that's already paid. This is on Bush's tab. It's already paid.
Well, yeah, actually, maybe the Bushes ought to pay for it. That'd be one of the penalties when they finally bring
them
to the world court or whatever. Tom, I got to do my top of the hour break, so thanks for listening from so far away. I appreciate it.
Yeah, think this through.
I am. I thought it through.
Yes.
Already.
I said you had the greatest point of the night.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Yeah, you can listen, of course, all over the country, WRIF.com. And usually we have a podcast up by noon, but WRIF will be closed for observance of the Martin Luther King holiday. So it'll be up Tuesday at noon. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan will be right back after these. You can call in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is Night Call. On 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Fox Sports Detroit is looking for a new song for our 2009 April in the D promotion. Do you have what it takes to compose the music that fans will sing this spring? Prices include $5,000, a music video, and a live performance at the WRIF Tigers home opener party at the Fillmore Theater. Go to aprilinthed.com for rules and details. Find out how to enter April in the D, coming this spring to Fox Sports Detroit.
ABS, traction and stability control, sway and roll equalizers, sweet enhancements to have, because winter in Michigan can turn road conditions treacherous in a matter of minutes. I know, because another driver lost control on an icy patch and whacked my car. My leg got jacked up and I couldn't work. That's when I called John Wallace at Financial Law Group.
This is attorney John Wallace from the Financial Law Group. If you've been injured in a car accident and it's affected your professional and personal life, or feel your insurance company is rushing you to settle, give me a call. I'll work on your behalf to resolve your legal issues in the simplest, most cost-effective way possible. If you need legal representation, call me.
If you have an accident, John is the first call you should make. Now listen up and add his number to your cell.
The Financial Law Group, 586-693-2000. Evening and weekend appointments available. Put the right people to work for you. Call 586-693-2000. The Financial Law Group, PC. Using the law to protect your financial future. 586-693-2000.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Hi, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. At 1 a.m., I'll be featuring a couple of interviews I did earlier in the week. The first one is with, do you know this guy, Greg Mortensen? He's written this book called Three Cups of Tea.
I have that book at home. My sister sent it to me for the holidays.
And actually, I have, is this the one man's mission to promote peace one school at a time? Is that the name of it? Because he's got a...
Yes, it is the name of it.
All right. Why I say that is that he's now got one out for junior readers and even a kid's book out. Anyway, he tells a story of how he helped to build almost 80 schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan amid the war. And he's going to be speaking in the Detroit area, let me see, a week from yesterday, a week from Sunday.
Very cool.
Yeah. And also Lamar Waldron rejoins me. He wrote Legacy of Secrecy about the JFK assassination, but he connects this all up, a lot of the same people.
It's amazing involved. How many guests you can have on that.
Yeah.
My God.
Well, this he's talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. We're now officially in the MLK holiday commemoration day.
Boy, there's a lot going on in this city tomorrow or today, isn't there?
Sure.
I was looking through the list of events. It's amazing. And you named the one event that you're going to be attending.
I'm
going to
be down at noon at the Central United Methodist Church on the corner of Woodward and East Adams, right? Just a little south, like the Fox and all that. And come on down. It'll be an incredible program. There'll also be a march through Detroit, the 6th annual Detroit Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day rally and march. for peace and economic justice. And
boy, could we use some of that.
Yeah, there's a noon rally and concludes with a march through downtown Detroit starting at 1:30. So a lot of people say, I don't want to march, too cold and all that. Well, whatever.
You can just go down and hang out. You don't have to march. It would be nice if you marched. I'd be there if I could.
Yeah, and the keynote speaker, I seem to have lost that, is Gloria House, who is, I think, a retired... Oh, yeah. Here it is. Dr. Gloria Aneb House, professor and director of humanities. Actually, she's not retired. I've retired her. And African-American studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn campus. Well, she's not at Wayne State anymore either. And she did a lot of work in Alabama in the 1960s and actually was present where a white racist came and shotgunned a white student, a white divinity student, killed him.
Wow.
That they were, and the guy was... let go. The guy with the shotgun said he was fearful that the unarmed young white student was going to harm him. So
sure.
That's how far we've come. Open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Oh, by the way, the story that I begin the interview with Greg Mortensen with takes off from what happened in Kandahar, Afghanistan. 2 months ago, a young girl and her sister were walking through the muddy streets of this Afghan city to the local girls' school when a man pulled up alongside on a motorcycle and posed what seemed like an ordinary question. Are you going to school? The man pulled Shamsia's burqa from her head and sprayed her face with burning acid.
This is what goes on over in a lot of countries, not just Afghanistan, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Pakistan, there's a lot of countries where this happens, and women are punished because they want to learn. Is that not disgusting?
And this is Greg Mortensen and his movement to create these schools.
They might get smart and mean like me.
Yeah, right. Well, these girls, it says, scars, jagged and discolored, now spread across Shamsia's eyelids and most of her left cheek. These days her vision goes blurry, but she's gone back to school, and she said she's going to continue. She doesn't let it deter her.
And I saw, if you go to nytimes.com, and if you'd like to see a picture that probably might not leave your imagery for a long time, there's a picture of her in there, post-acid burning, and it is just horrible.
Yeah. Now, one of the ways that Barack Obama tried to compensate for giving this homophobic preacher, Reverend Rick Warren, a prominent spot in delivering the invocation at the inauguration, he invited the V. Gene Robinson, the openly gay Episcopal bishop of New Hampshire, to deliver the invocation at the inaugural event yesterday, Sunday, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Rick Warren, he was preaching the other day, and compared himself to Hitler, Lenin, Mao. I mean, sort of indirectly.
Excuse me?
He said when a man like Hitler was up here and he had, millions of followers, and he said the same thing about Lenin and Mao. He says, but he wants people to do that for Jesus. But it was an extraordinarily odd example.
He's odd.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to our phones, 313-298-WRIF, and here's Joe in Disgusta Township. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter. I'm sure you know why I call it Disgusta Township, because of the kind of racist vibe that's out here. I've been working at this store here since the last the switching of office, back in the Gore Bush election. And, so I remember the whole taking the guns thing. Al Gore's going to take my guns. You know, they do that with the Democrats.
Every single one.
Oh, yeah. They think they think that's why Gore lost Tennessee.
Sure. But what I really want to address here is just that racism, those jokes. Jolene, I hear those jokes, and they're vile and disgusting. I was so upset by them. We're MySpace friends. And, you may have seen the bulletin that I put out.
Oh.
I was so upset by it. Here's the number for the Secret Service. If you hear somebody saying something, let them sort it out. Let them figure it out. There was a guy here at a bar in Ypsilanti that the Secret Service came and paid him a visit for, saying something about Bush. The number
really
is easily found in the front of any phone book. It's on page 2 in my phone book under the emergency phone numbers, U.S. Secret Service Detroit. I'm all the way out by Ann Arbor, so all of Southeast Michigan.
So
if you hear something, it's 313-226-6400.
Drop a dime on the racist.
I'm going to drop a dime on that guy in that works with us.
Yeah, let him sort it out.
You know, it really, it's, and you have to, you know, you try to maintain a nice working relationship and the peace at work. But I tell you, when you're stuck in a radio studio, you can't get out because you got to switch to the next song. You're stuck, man.
Yeah, well, you know, think about this. George Bush is going to be president up until about noon on Tuesday. So if we dropped a dime on this guy right now, they might arrest him on Monday, and he could be tortured because, you know, Bush has turned the U.S. into
totally
a torture state.
It.
Maybe they rendition him, fly him off to Syria and...
Do a little waterboarding, last waterboarding to say sayonara world.
Do you think this guy is listening to our show?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
He's not smart enough.
Yeah, right. He's probably abusing drugs or alcohol right now.
I don't think that's the one thing. I think he needs to.
All right, Joe. Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thanks,
your call.
Joe.
Here's Scott in Birmingham. Hi, Scott. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air with us on WRIF.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I'm a gun-owning outdoorsman, and I think it's absolutely ridiculous that anybody would think that Barack Obama is going to take our guns away.
Yeah.
First, he lacks the power to do it. He's only the president. He can't make law. He just simply can't do it. And even if, say, Congress wanted to make a law to take our guns away, they can't do it. The Supreme Court last year came down with that case that said that everybody has an individual personal right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah. They essentially decided the second – this has been debated since the 1920s. And, in fact, the court reversed precedent and said it had to do not with an armed militia, that was kind of the standard interpretation of the Second Amendment, but as you said very correctly, Scott, that individuals have the right to keep and bear arms. So,
No worries.
Yeah.
I think people use, I think the gun salesman who called in earlier really is, this is the greatest forum to call in and sell some guns, right?
Yeah, there you go.
In my opinion, am I still online?
Sure,
yeah.
You are.
Yeah, I think that the Second Amendment is one of the most overrated amendments in the Constitution. It really doesn't give us a whole lot.
You're going to get them going.
Guns don't protect rights hardly at all.
That what?
Guns don't protect rights hardly at all.
Well, that's what, I mean, somehow these people that think a lot about these things, they believe that that individual gun ownership is a hedge against a tyrannical government. But particularly a modern political state has an armed force that is so powerful that it's not like 1776 where, you know, you go get your neighbor and your muskets and you can stand up to the soldiers of the British Empire. I mean, the only way that, if it ever comes down to armed force, the only way that in modern society that armed citizenry can do anything, in fact, they're not even really necessary to the process, has to be some sector of the armed forces comes over to the people's side and decides that the old government is out of here. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think it's way overrated. All right, thank you very much. Whoa! I mean, I don't even want to talk about that much. If you don't think it's overrated, fine. That's okay. Don't get into it. All right, here is Kevin in Detroit. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
How you doing, Pete?
Good.
All right. I'm a black man from the city of Detroit, been listening to you for 26 years.
Oh, right on.
And I agree with your guess. I just think this gun issue is totally overblown. If it's not that, it's this kookball minister. And I met the guy's a nut, some of the things he said, Reverend Wright, some of those things.
Jeremiah Wright. People are still on that, aren't they?
No, but the things he said were just way out of left field, some of the things he said. You know, I mean, it just isn't right for no race of people to be saying about anybody.
Yeah.
Period. Okay. Yeah, but like I said, Pete, you keep. I rate you up there with Keith Olbermann. Pete.
Well,
man, you up there?
TV show.
Keith Olbermann.
I thought I had a face for radio.
No, I've been listening to you. I'm a black guy. I've been listening to you for 26 years since '85, and I always have enjoyed your program.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. And did you get what we said that we were saying that as white people, we feel that we really can't totally feel as deeply as you do.
No, I think that if people of goodwill internally can feel a certain way, I'm not.
So you think we can, then, huh?
Yeah, I think, okay. I mean, because the color, what really makes a person wasn't internal, what's inside. That's what I think.
Kevin, did you say you're 85 years old?
No, I said I've listened since you listened to your program since 1985.
Oh, okay.
You don't say who's hazy. It's like Benjamin Button or whatever.
Yeah, I was going to say, wow, well, you go back into a different era, but no, I hear you. All right, Kevin, thank you so much.
Thanks,
all right.
Kevin. All right.
Appreciate your call. I was helping my teacher, my Tai Chi teacher, teach a class to seniors, and it's a mixed racial class at a senior center in Southfield. And there were a number of African-American women with Obama T-shirts. And and sometimes, you know, I don't know why that makes some white people angry. You know, I mean, groups that are, if you're not WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, most groups are very, very proud and promoting of people within their ethnic group that achieve things, whether they're Italian or Jews or Greeks or African-Americans or Mexican-Americans, whatever, Hispanic-Americans. And
Polish
Americans, yeah, sure. So, why in the world anybody would, you know, they go, you know, like that.
What? They're just so angry. Yeah.
Look at oneself. I mean, I actually was it my teacher that was saying this? When you have advice for someone else, the first person you should give to is yourself.
It really is true almost 100% of the time.
Yeah, so I find
myself giving the advice and go, you know, God, I really should do that too.
But I guess what I'm thinking is when you all of a sudden feel this devil of resentment inside of you, this small anger, this...
Like I do for right-wingers, like you do? So what are we supposed to do?
We're supposed to have compassion for them.
Compassion,
They've moved away from their Buddha nature.
I have compassion for all the ignorance in the world.
Let's do a little oming right now.
Okay, om. Compassion for ignorance. I feel better. Wow, you did the complete om.
Hey, have you ever been in a room where...
I have.
If you people
full
think
of ohms?
Full of ohms?
I have. Yeah. Many, many rooms full of ohms.
That is... And that... I don't know what is... I don't even know the origins of it very much. I used to. I forgot.
Well, a lot of it is. I mean, I've done it in yoga class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is it?
It's a meditation portion.
But it's Indian, isn't it? Yeah, it's Indian Sanskrit. Maybe.
Yeah.
I think Om is All right, come on. One of you listening know all this. So stop letting us.
You all know.
Flail around like this. Flail around like this. But there is something that you have these variety of voices, these, you know, deep male voices and these higher women's voices and all that. And when you have 8, 10, 12, 20 people doing that, and sometimes you can extend the sound, it is vibrational.
It's absolutely vibrational. Yeah. It's downright hot. Hey, Peter, let's give the numbers, because we do have three open lines. Yeah. Okay. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. I'm reading.
Good job, Peter.
CallTalkYes@yahoo.com is our email address, if you'd like to go that way. And also my personal email is peterwerbe, WERBE.com. Lots of stuff there. We also have a MySpace and a Facebook page. And those of you who are into that,
just search Night Call with Peter and Julene, or just Night Call Detroit. You'll find us.
Where? Either one. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Under the search mechanism.
And as usual, thank you to Debbie in Northampton.
Yeah, yes. Mass
for helping us out on that.
Yeah, well, she saved my butt.
Here is Lars in Madison Heights. Lars, hi. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I have two important announcements to make.
Okay.
One is I have certain chapters of Iraq Veterans Against the War have actually bought airtime before Obama's inauguration. Will be running a commercial calling on Americans to end war now.
Really?
And that will be locally?
I don't believe. Well, I don't know. They haven't bought airtime in Detroit, but it's already on YouTube. But they want to withhold until it airs live during, like, right before the inauguration. It'll be on NBC affiliates in L.A. and I believe also Rochester and other major cities.
Nice. Cool. Yeah.
Actually, go ahead.
I was going to start my other point.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. My other thing is the specific fear that some gun owners have of Barack Obama is not that he's going to confiscate weapons, but that he'll actually ban civilians from owning features on weapons.
Features?
And the weapons, like splash suppressors, bayonet lugs, folding stocks, and certain other magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. But if So because they can't confiscate privately owned property or deprive people the right to bear arms, any weapons made before the ban would be grandfathered and appreciate in value because they would have the ban features.
Oh, well, I think when he was a state senator, he may have voted for some of those laws as well, you know, in the state. But that doesn't mean he's going to do it. I mean, he does introduce legislation. He could ask that
he's not going to.
Based on that, some of the people in his cabinet were responsible for the Bill Clinton era assault weapon ban, and they think, but even though he's got his hands full, you know, he might do pass something like that just to make the appearance of progress.
Now, why would someone want these features? What is the benefit of having the features?
Mainly, it's collectible.
Yeah, it is.
Military weapons tend to be more ergonomic than civilian weapons.
Yeah, I mean, the outlaws, as they say, they can have the you know, the flash. What do they call that? Flash suppressor.
All the flash suppressor really does is if you're shooting in the dark, you won't lose your night vision.
Yeah.
It really doesn't do anything to enhance the lethality of the weapon. Neither does a pistol grip, a folding stock.
Well, a folding stock, I mean, the overall length of a long gun, there's a certain federal standard, and if you have a collapsible or, as you call it, foldable stock, it takes it below that, that's illegal now.
No, actually, if in Michigan, federally, it's 26 inches. In Michigan, it's 30.
Right.
And I happen to have three AK-47s that have folding stocks, so they had to be registered as pistols.
You have three AK-47s?
Yeah, I bought one a couple weeks ago, because even if it gets banned, it's just going to appreciate in value.
So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You're just collecting.
Well, yeah, but I'm actually federally, I'm probably the only anti-war activist who's federally licensed to collect weapons.
Really?
There you go, Lars.
That's
all right,
amazing.
Thank you. We'll look for those ads.
Oh, listen, we got an email. This is good. I am here. I'm drunk again and still unemployed. I'm sorry, but I liked it.
All right, let's here's an explanation. Here's Eric from Detroit. He's going to tell us about Buddha Nature and Om.
Well, good morning.
Good morning to you, Eric. You're on the air.
First of all, my congratulations to the gentleman who is an anti-war activist.
Absolutely.
You mentioned the Buddha Nature, and I have been a 34-year practitioner of Nichiren Buddhism.
Hmm.
So that is a subject with which I am deeply familiar. I believe Om is a Hindu mantra.
Okay.
There are mantras and there are mudras. Mudras are hand gestures, and the mantras are particular sounds to create a particular vibration. In Nichiren Buddhism, the mantra is Nam Myoho Renge Kyo.
Yes, I know that one.
Excellent.
I like Om better. It's a lot easier.
But once you get the Nam Myoho Renge Kyo, it's very easy.
Oh, yes.
Look at her.
It sounds quite foreign in the beginning.
Yeah, it sure does.
But once you get into it and you absorb the definition and feel the vibration of it, it becomes much more familiar to you.
And what's it supposed to produce? I mean, like I said, you do get this amazing feeling if you're oming with lots of people. But
you're letting the outside world go and going deep within yourself, right?
No, not necessarily, because the outside world and the inside world are inextricably linked.
Oh, but only for a few moments at least.
No, you never exit the real world. It's a very, very important point.
Okay.
You mentioned the sound of many people doing Om.
Yeah, the vibrations.
When I was a two-year member, I went to the Shrine Auditorium, and there were 5,000 people there chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo.
Oh, my gosh.
The sound was beatific.
Huh.
It really deeply impressed me. But when one is chanting, meditation is a portion of it. But it's all based upon law of causality.
Law of cause and effect.
Yes. And when you're chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, you are making the highest possible cause to bring from within you the Buddha nature. The Buddha nature exists in all things. The difference between human beings and animals is that human beings can realize it actively by chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Buddha nature.
So do I.
Yes.
Most religions that I have encountered, and I spent 10 years from 18 to 28 studying religions informally until I became extremely angry. But most religions consider the human being as being basically flawed and in need of the intercession of something outside of themselves in order to correct. Buddhism assumes that your perfect nature exists within you and you must bring it out. I use the analogy of exercise. You know you have a muscle in your arm, but until you begin to exercise that muscle, you don't see it. You begin to see it grow. It comes out. It emerges. I don't want to get too much detailed, but there's a concept called the 9 levels of consciousness. The first 5 of those levels are your senses, sight, touch, hearing, smell, sight, and all 5 of them. The 6th is the level at which these previous 5 are integrated so that you see the same thing you hear and you smell the same thing you taste. The 7th is the level of self-awareness, which can be enlightening in itself, but it also has the danger of being aware of yourself and the other and separating yourself from the other. The 8th level is the karma storage. For every cause that is made, there is karma created, and the effect emerges from that with the proper stimulus from the environment. The 9th level is the Buddha nature. When one chants Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, one pierces all of these levels and brings forth the Buddha nature. Now,
you finally have brought it out of yourself.
I feel better right now just hearing about it.
And if people are going the other way, they're moving away from their Buddha nature, and rather than being angry and condemnatory of them, like we are of George Bush and Dick Cheney.
We're judgers.
When judgers.
We have rights to judge those two, though.
We should have compassion for these people because they move so far from their Buddha nature.
I felt better for a second, Peter. Then you brought those two cats up
again. They are definitely going to be reborn about 10,000 more times and not get off Wheel of Life till they do some heavy penance. Hey, Eric.
They will never achieve enlightenment.
Eric, thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Eric, by the way, I feel relaxed right now.
Everybody ought to be deeply thankful for George Bush.
Why? Right. Oh, because of the awareness.
No, because if it had not been for George Bush, you see, black people could not have elected Obama by themselves. But George Bush pissed off so many Americans that they finally turned around and said, my God, we're in such bad straits. A black man would be better than this. And they elected Obama.
Well, actually, I know a woman who made, I guess that's sort of saying vaguely, I guess that's sort of like being partially pregnant, a racist statement. She said she could never vote for a black guy. And then she saw the debate between Biden and Penn, and she said, I changed him.
Yeah, bring it on.
All right, Eric, thank you so much. I appreciate it, you calling in with that.
And this says, Om is sacred syllable of Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism.
Sikhism, yeah.
Sikhism.
Yeah. And I think it's Sanskrit. The language is Sanskrit.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Most sacred syllable in the ancient Sanskrit language of India.
You want to try one more?
What?
An om?
Om. And by the way, Peter's really taking this seriously. You should see him.
Why'd you stop?
I don't know.
All right.
I like to om in private.
Okay, here's Eric in Ypsilanti. Hi, Eric, on the air.
Oh, hey, Peter and Julene.
Hey, hi. Eric.
I'm one of the few blacks that didn't vote for Obama because I had some concerns about him with his policy against free trade agreements and arresting George Bush, Dick Cheney.
Arrest him? I don't think I think he should arrest him, but I don't think he will.
And I'll tell you what, agreed on the trade thing. I don't think he's going to take us big places and be Mr. Fair Trade by any means.
I know. And by the way, I'm one of your MySpace friends.
Oh, we're MySpace friends?
Yes, ma'am.
What's your name?
My name's Eric.
Oh, I know who you are, Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I just wanted to clarify that I'm a real person.
You are. Well, now I know. In the flesh, sort of.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Thank you, Eric.
Appreciate it.
Friends.
Yeah, yeah. On your MySpace or our MySpace?
On both.
Okay.
Yeah, I know who Eric is.
Okay. Actually, I want to hear this. Here's Paul from Detroit, from the Detroit Liberation. What's the rest of it? I'm sorry.
.org.
.org, yeah. Hi, Paul.
The guy who throws a Liberation Day party downtown Detroit. I just wanted to add a little bit to the discussion about Eastern meditation and
sure.
tell you that, surprisingly, Willie Nelson is actually going on tour teaching Eastern philosophy and meditation. He's calling it his On the Road Again tour.
Oh, my gosh. Road. Is that not great?
Yeah.
If I didn't love Willie Nelson enough.
It's a joke. On the Road Again.
We get it. We get it.
We get it. I really thought he was.
Should we should we tell?
Okay. My blonde is showing.
Should we tell people how much you love Willie Nelson?
How much?
That you named your...
I named my dog after him. I did. I have a basset hound named Willie Nelson.
I love you even more.
I love you too.
All right. Thank you guys.
Paul, before you go, you with me? Paul?
Yeah.
Paul.
And okay. No more jokes, by the way, because I'm really gullible when it comes to jokes.
Yeah. Do you know that gullible is not in the
Don't
dictionary?
Even,
okay.
I learned that one years ago.
Paul and DetroitLiberation.org every spring puts on a legalized marijuana rally. I spoke at the last one. And anything happening for this year?
Well, actually, I'm putting together some details. I would love for you to be there. Actually, looking for suggestions. People can get to DetroitLiberation.org and email me with their suggestions or contacts. And I'm also speaking to the Skeptic Society of Michigan, CFI Michigan, about a talk called Skeptical About Marijuana Laws at the Redford Township Library on March 19th, which is... Skeptic Society is basically a community for exploring ideas from rational, scientific, non-theistic perspectives.
Cool.
Everything from science, religion, philosophy, social issues, politics, humanism, skepticism, evolution, morality, ethic, rationalism, etc.
Wait a minute. Are you reading that?
Partially, yes.
Okay, good, good. No, I'm glad. I'm glad you are. It would be
I have a good memory.
It would be frightening if you were talking.
We work with somebody who has a memory like that.
We do?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yes, right.
Rocket memory.
Hey,
it's scary.
Paul, do this. If you mail me the information of this as email, text, or a Microsoft Word document. No attachment. Microsoft Word. Let me start again. If you mail this to me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com as email, text, I'll put it on my calendar page at peterwerby.com, okay?
I would appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for doing the good work that you are doing. 313-298-WRIF, Peter Werby, Jillian Jordan. We will be right back.
This is Night Call on 101-WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. 101-WRIF, WRIF, HD1 Detroit.
Hello.
How are you?
It's Mike, and Friday morning we were watching the news reports on a big old airline landing in the Hudson River. NBC's Brian Williams threw it to this reporter on a scene who was clueless. Listen close to the producers and directors in his ear screaming at him to go, 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 start talking, you idiot.
Mike Taibbi, among the first journalists responding to the story. He's Lower Manhattan for us tonight. Mike, what's the latest?
So we were encouraged a moderation.
Whoa.
Go Mike. Come on, him. I know he's go. Mike
Taibbi.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear anything except Chris. Well, all right. There's a pilot named Chesley Sully Sullenberger who by tomorrow will be a co-pilot.
Oh, my God. You've got to be kidding me. If we can hear it, why can't he hear it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, go, my going. What does he think that means?
There's nothing quite like coverage of live breaking news.
Isn't it great? Oh, it's fantastic.
It really is.
Yeah, that's when you want to watch a story when first breaks and everybody is trying to be the first one get it on the air, and they'll interview anybody that comes along to say anything. Tonight, Mike, what's the latest?
So we would encourage a moderation. Go Mike.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear anything except Chris. Well, all right. There's a pilot named Chesley Sully Sullenberger who by tomorrow will be a folk hero in this country.
Mike in the morning on 101 WREF.
You know, we all know someone.
All right, $9 million.
All of you who have stuck with me.
By 100,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 ahead.
Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message on the web. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
Phone blown up.
Welcome back to the Ritz Award-winning Hot Show on 101
WRIF. I guess it's my turn now. Stepped all over the guy, didn't I?
Poor guy. Ouch.
Peter Worby, Jalene Jordan, until 1 o'clock, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Do you know where all that was from?
Which, the song?
Yeah.
What was that the MC5?
I guess you can't. Yeah, that was recorded live at Detroit Grandy Ballroom on October 31st, 1968, the MC5. And they had this this MC that they called Reverend Jess Crawford. And he
get up there and do his thing.
Yeah.
Got an email from Joe in Chesterfield and says he works at one of the retail stores in the area that's closing. We were talking about Circuit City and there's several. And he said he wants to ask the people who shop the sales, because there's these huge sales. Everyone's like, you need to go to Circuit City right now because you can get this and that and that. Well, realize that the reason they're getting the good deal on the stuff, and keep it in mind, is because the business is failing. More people will be out of work. He had a customer who commented that we should have more going out of business sales.
Ooh.
And he said it's all he could do to keep from telling this person that that he was an inconsiderate jerk. We all suffer when the economy is bad. And you are right. And Joe, we wish the best.
Yeah. Just a rug pulled out from under.
Yeah.
How do you do it? All right. 313-298-WRIF. There are open lines for you. Here is Ed in Rockwood. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Everybody's talking about Obama banning guns and everything. He don't really have to ban them. He just has to make them to where people can't afford them. Like he said he was going to tax ammo 500%.
You know, he never said that. You show
he
me.
Didn't?
No. Nope. Yeah, you know, you hear, that's what I'm saying, Ed. I just got an email from somebody who's done some work for me in the past, and it was the whole thing about they were going to put a $2.50 tax on everything. All ammo would be ID'd so that, it's not in the cards. One of the things, there are some states that may, in fact, introduce that legislation, and that could be fought out on a state-by-state level for the people that object to it. But Barack Obama has no intention of doing that. One of the things I've been writing people, there's an urban legend site. It's called Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S.com. And you go there, and you can put in, like, Obama and ammo. Actually,
or you can put Obama in his birth certificate
or anything like that. But I just, after maybe all the years of biz, I can almost tell when things are fakes.
When it's an urban legend.
Yeah, when it's some supposedly a George Carlin quote or something like that.
Oh, yeah. You know what's funny? My next door neighbor is really keeps getting caught up in these urban legends.
Thank you, Ed.
And I can't remember one that she, I remember the one that she was, what was the one where they were combining the Americas? And what's the name of the daughter that it was going to be?
Amaro, the Amaro.
Amaro, and she's telling me this, and I look at her, and I just go, listen to me. You need to trust me on this one. It's an urban legend. It's not true. And she goes, no, Jean, I'm not kidding you. So the next day she goes to work, she logs on, and she emails me. She goes, here's the link. You're right. She went to Snopes.
This will, we can send people, I can't remember, what is it, the North American Union, right, the NAU.
Yeah.
That the presidents of Mexico and Canada, I'm sorry, the presidents of Mexico and the United States, George Bush and Calderon from Mexico, met with Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, to set out the basis of this North American Union that would have the same properties of the European Union, and they even designed and prototypes of this dollar that would be the euro. Except this will be the Amaro. Well,
yeah.
There's not a single bit of truth in it at all. Zero. Except there are maybe millions of people.
Who believe it.
Yeah, I get people I know and have respect for. Although I got to tell you, I'm not so sure what the real problem with that would be. I mean, it's nothing that exercises me greatly.
One world, man. Hey, Peter, we got an email from Paul who says a number of his friends have saved their Christmas trees and they're coming together for an unofficial bush burning party. I thought you might have heard about such plans. Persevere, Paul. Isn't that great? I have not come up with anything. What have I been doing? I've got to do something monumental. I've been crying and whining and my gut has been aching for 8 long years.
So you're not working on Tuesday?
Oh, no.
Okay.
That is my day.
Well, here, wait a minute. I don't think it doesn't have. Let me see. Let me quickly go. Can I do it? Okay, yeah. All right, here we are. If you go to my website, peterwerbe.com. By the way, today I'm going to be doing my regular HD show. That's high definition radio. And if you go to my website, peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and it'll be a lot of songs related to the observance of Martin Luther King, including a wonderful version of Blown in the Wind by Stevie Wonder. Absolutely incredible piece, yeah. But
that would be beautiful.
2 p.m. to 7 p.m. today. All right. But before that, here I'm going to be down at the Central Methodist Church at noon, where there will be the 6th annual Detroit Dr. Martin Luther King Day rally and march. But on Tuesday, Michigan Coalition for Human Rights invites you to celebrate history with the 2009 presidential inauguration, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Mary Grove College. In the Madame Cadillac building. That's at,
where is that? Yeah.
It's on McNichols, right near Wyoming.
Okay.
And you can view the inauguration on a projector screen with refreshments. You go to mchr.org. mchr.org. Okay? So,
excellent.
You want to do that? Maybe we will.
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't want to cry in front of all those people.
Well, they'll probably be crying too.
I know.
Here's another comment on Om chanting. Unfortunately, I don't have your name up there. Hi, it's Ben Jolene. Who's this?
Hey, Ron.
Hi, Ron.
How are you?
Right
now. About that Om thing?
Yeah
the like Om thing.
Well, you know, Om Dao, Pami Dao. Om, according to the Taoist thing, is basically, you still there?
I'm waiting. Yeah, we're here.
Okay, basically, during the sexual act, men say, women say, oh, and say,
no.
If you ever can, if you two try it together.
We're not doing it. I'm not doing it.
No, it becomes circular and becomes a Tao. So it's the Om, Tao, Padme Tao. I'm not sure what the Padme Tao means, but. Yeah. Tell you 10,000 things.
Yeah, I think my wife would be upset if.
You can do it with circle friends. Oh. They have the women do the O part and the men do the M part, and it goes it becomes circular.
Oh, for real?
For real?
I thought this was
like
a
No.
Sweat lodges and stuff in California.
Oh, sweat lodges. Oh, I've done that once before.
Well, it's kind of a thing, but. You just try it. Get a circle of friends and say there's two or three males.
What if it's all babes? What do you do?
Well, then I guess you just still say, oh. The guys would sit around with fingers on chin saying,
Yeah.
Well, maybe we could try it at the...
it's basically that's where it came from.
Okay, I got it. All right, well, we could maybe do it when we're watching the...
inauguration.
Yeah.
We'll have an Om circle.
All right, okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Here is Dennis. Dennis is in Dearborn Heights. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Jolene.
Hi, Dennis.
The Detroit Auto Show is just open this Saturday.
So I was there today.
How was it?
Well, you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but after I moved here in 1998, this is the first time I've ever been to it. And but from what everyone down there told me, that it was much more scaled down.
Sure.
And I thought it was, you know, I thought it was perfect the way it was. If it was any glitzier, it must have been real glitzy.
Yeah, we were broadcasting from there all afternoon.
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
Yeah, just as a mere spectator.
Right, I was working. And I walked through all the displays, and you know, but I understood that the displays were much more extravagant in years past. But I thought it was lovely.
Well, the question I have, and it might go out to some of your viewers, but you might have some ideas on this also, but the big push in the media and so forth is with the electric cars and hybrids.
That's what I should have said. The one thing that I did notice is the push for hybrid, electric, and green. It was everywhere. It was very futuristic, as it often is with concept cars, but I think it was probably more than usual. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, there's an article in the paper talking about some things. How do we power up these electric cars? And they're saying we don't have an electrical grid that can supply the amount of electricity as it stands now.
Right.
And I know in Michigan, there was also an article, and my memory might be a little fuzzy on this, but I thought they said 5 coal plants that they want to put up in Michigan, but they're kind of blocked by environmentalists now. And same thing with nuclear plants. There's issues with them. So, you know, the thing about going green and so forth, electric, you know, and I even wonder with the coal plants, you know, to produce that electricity, you're burning coal and you're almost defeating the purpose because you're creating a lot of pollution.
It's very dirty.
Terrible. And then when what's left over are those lagoons of coal ash that are, they're stored up with nowhere to put it.
Yes, so are we any further ahead by saying, yes, let's go electric? You know, is it 6 of 1, half dozen of another? If we say we're going electric, everyone likes to think that's green. But to produce the electricity to provide these vehicles their power, you're damaging the environment that way.
You know, Dennis, if you check out a book called, I'm forgetting the author. Edwin Black. He wrote a book called Internal Combustion. And one of the things he relates is the almost alliance between Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. And Edison envisioned all electric cars. And for a while, Ford was on board with this. And there were a lot of electric cars in the U.S. Something like half the cabs in New York City in about 1910 were electric or something like that. But in any event, he envisioned a small windmill at every house that would not only power the house with electricity, but would also juice up your car. I don't know. I don't know how that would all sound.
Like hum. Is there a grill? Is there a grill next to it? You'd be right in hum.
All right. Thank you very much. But I agree with you that it's not the end all. Thank you very much.
Because that's a point I hadn't even really thought about.
Because
that.
How do you power all these cars? Say, okay, we're not importing any more oil, and we don't have to keep mucking around in Asia and Middle East and fighting all these wars to protect
them. Right.
Our oil sources, which is the only reason that we're over there. And instead, though, you got to power up all these cars. How are you going to do that? Well, coal plants, man, these things are, there's no such thing as clean coal.
Yeah, and they have those clean coal technology commercials. Don't buy it.
Yeah. All right, 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, here is Sam. Sam is from Macomb Township. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi, Owen Peter. I was calling, I don't want to get off topic, but I was calling about the, are you talking about the North American Union thing?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I was wondering if you have ever seen the movie Zeitgeist?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't bring it in to me. I don't think it makes it. One of the things.
But there are a lot of believers who watch that one. Whoa, man!
One of the things that I say when you're evaluating new information and important information, probably a video is the absolute worst source because you don't have any time to really think critically. It's moving along too fast. They have all this montage of images whose purpose is to leave you with the impression that the producers want.
But
I don't think there's a single bit of evidence to suggest that because these three leaders of North America met, that they actually decided all. So go to Snopes.com, put in North American Union, and see what you get. That's one thing. But let me ask you this. What would be wrong with a North American Union?
Well, I honestly don't think there's anything wrong with it. The one thing that kind of freaks me out, though, because you see, like, videos popping up around here and over there on the Internet about once the North American Union happens and there's an emerging Asian Union, emerging African Union, and then once everybody is their own union, the last thing to do is to become the one world government, which is supposedly the new world order. I don't know what your take is on that at all.
I think it's silly stuff through and through. Yeah, I mean, what this supposes is there's this grand conspiracy run by I don't know who that wants this new world order, one world government, and they have these plans, and there's all these people that are these pawns of it, these bankers and these used to be communists, but I guess they're old fashioned now. But there's no substantive evidence for that whatsoever. There's no I mean, who was it? Was it, yeah, it was Bush 1 that talked about a new world order, which probably was a real mistake, one of the many that that Poppy Bush
Yeah, but made. He went out the 40% approval rating,
yeah, yeah,
not
yeah.
22.
And it of all things we have to worry about, a new world order, one world government, or a North American Union just is not one of them. They're not on the agenda. All right. Thank you, Sam.
You know, it really is amazing, though, how many people are stressed out by so many things today. I think there's too much information. There's too much going on. It's a little overwhelming.
Well, one of the things about conspiracy theories, and there are conspiracies. I don't mean to.
Oh, yeah. God, I heard a good one today. I can't remember. I keep talking. It was a doozy.
Essentially, is that we are powerless. I mean, that it's actually disempowering. People think, well, if we have the information is power. Well, information is not power. Information is important to understand accurately what is what's happening and have an information that creates a vision of how we would want things to change. But if we are fighting these invisible forces that have tentacles everywhere and that have the capacity to control, you know, the United Nations and business and banking, I mean, what's what a guy in Macomb Township to do against the forces that are laid against us? Right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, the one I heard today was that this was someone who said, "I really believe that the plane that went down in the Hudson River." It was all planned.
Really?
True. Yeah, I think, and it's like, you know, it was directly kind of down ground zero, you know what I mean? And I don't know. I really got nothing on this one. You know, people always bring their conspiracies to us.
Yeah. I think that one of the things I thought about was that, boy, that sure blew Bush off of all the front pages. Because remember he had that farewell speech, that whining, lying.
Wasn't it? It was 17 minutes long or 13 minutes long, his last final speech. And I'm one of these Facebook crazies, you know. Yeah. And you put the status and I said, taking the garbage out rather than listen to any more of his lies.
I heard part of it. You want me to repeat what I heard?
Yeah.
And then I turned it off.
Nice.
Really?
You know, I saw him coming on. I'm like, no, not this. Him again.
Yeah. Let me just bring up a few loose ends before we get to our interviews. The interview coming up, by the way, at 1 a.m. is with Greg Mortensen. Greg Mortensen.
This is going to be good.
Yeah. Wrote Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission. Promote peace one school at a time. This is a guy that created all these schools in Afghanistan. And boy, the Taliban kidnapped him. Do you know that?
No, I haven't read it yet. It's sitting at home.
And next Sunday, he's going to be at next Sunday, he's going to be at the Berkeley High School Auditorium. Free talk. Yeah. All right. One of the things that always amazes me is how things get kind of, I don't know, almost institutionalized in the media. And one of them, of course, is the antipathy. The dislike that the media has for Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, now, what has he done wrong? Why are we Americans supposed
to
dislike him?
You are throwing this out 2 minutes, 3 minutes before going off the air?
Yeah, we got just a couple of minutes left. But here's what he's done wrong. He's called Bush the devil. Right?
Yeah.
He's, I don't know. What else has he done wrong? What has he done
wrong?
Yes. He's part of this process where Citgo gives cheap fuel oil to 200,000 American families.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the Bronx, and there's several areas where he does that.
And it's administered by Joseph Kennedy III, the son of Robert Kennedy.
And he gives a portion of the proceeds from the oil that he sells to the poor of his country.
Yeah. Now,
not enough.
There's not stockholders, even. So instead of all the oil money, when you go to Citgo, even though if you're paying $4 a gallon, it doesn't go to enrich the stockholders.
Right.
It goes to partly back to poor people in our country, but to poor people around the hemisphere.
Okay, so there's some good.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Anyway, here, big headline. Venezuela's Chavez urges tear gas against protests. Whoa, this evil guy. What sort of evil government use tear gas on its own citizens that are protesting?
Oh, wait. You and I have both been sprayed. Yeah. I can't even count how many times I've been sprayed.
So Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez ordered police on Saturday to use tear gas on anti-government protest that blocked roads, hitting up a campaign for referendum that would allow him to run for re-election. And saying, oh, here, this is proof he's a dictator. He wants to be president for life. Well, the only thing is, this is not very unusual. that there are any number of governments that allow repeated
terms.
Terms.
Yeah. You know, I really believe if GW were given the opportunity to run again, he wouldn't have. He is ragged ass. He wants out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you seen it lately?
He looks bad.
Yeah.
Now, Venezuelans will vote next month in a proposed change to the Constitution that would allow Chavez a foe of the United States. He's not a foe of the United States. See, this is the language you get here. He's a foe of George W. Bush.
That's right.
I'm a foe of George W. Bush.
Yeah.
82% of the American people.
That's right.
Let me see. 78% of the American people.
You still have your Christmas tree. You can have your little burn it party. Is that legal?
To seek re-election when his term ends in 4 years. Now, small groups of students in gas masks wielding plastic shields protested the proposal this week. Well, what do you think would happen if we came out and protested? I mean, usually when the cops attack us, I mean, we're unarmed, right?
Yeah, we're wearing bandanas and flip-flops.
They threw stones at police, blocked the highway, and set fires to a national park.
We'd be... Yeah. So
our ass would be grass.
Our ass would be waterboarded.
Yeah. In the meantime, Lebanese security forces fired tear gas and water cannons at dozens of angry demonstrators near the U.S. Embassy.
Ouch.
Yeah. Well, I think my voice is giving out, but maybe...
Does that mean it's time to go?
It is.
All right.
It is. Let me see. Yeah, we'll even start... I guess we'll start our interviews a couple minutes early.
Okay. Well, it's been a great night. Thanks to everyone who called. Thanks to Al for answering the phones.
Come on down to Central Methodist Church, Woodward and Adams, tomorrow at noon for...
Which is today, Monday,
for the celebration of the birth of Martin Luther King. And there's a lot of other events as well around town. A lot of them are at my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, on the calendar section. Jillian Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Al Slayer.
You're the best, man.
You're the best, absolutely. And callers, listeners, appreciate it as well. We'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
The future is here. We do not need to be afraid anymore.
From your iPhone 3G, download the free WRIF app at the App Store. It gives you untouched access to WRIF streaming live wherever you are. For more details, WRIF.com.
We wanted to give you more on the riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all. We said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
Riff 2 is music made for the Motor City and totally commercial free. Log on from anywhere in the world at Riff2.com. Everything rocks.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
101 WRIF and MGM Grand Detroit bring you the Strip Down Lounge. With all this week's year's chance to win VIP passes to an intimate performance of Scott Weiland. A hosted acoustic at MGM Grand Detroit's Ignite T-Barn Lounge. Wednesday, January 28th, you'll also score tickets to see Scott's concert plugged in at St. Andrews Hall here that night. Listen and win from MGM Grand Detroit. The ultimate entertainment experience at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Peter Werbe with you. Thank you for joining me. And it's a pleasure to bring to our microphone someone who very likely many of you have heard of. He's Greg Mortensen, and he's the co-author of Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. And he's going to be in the Detroit area. But for those of you who may not be familiar with this incredible New York Times best-selling author, Three Cups of Tea is written by the co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Central Asia Institute. He's also the founder of Pennies for for Peace. I want to talk about that. That's an amazing story in itself. And Mortensen has dedicated his life to promoting community-based education and literacy programs, especially for girls and in the remote mountain regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan. In 1993, Greg Mortensen climbed Pakistan's K2. That's the second highest in the world, and he ran into some problems. He recovered in a local village, and he met a group of children writing with sticks in the sand, and he made a promise to help them build a school. He did that. He took on this remarkable campaign, and he's established more than 60 schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan that provides education to more than 25,000 children, including 14,000 girls. Now, there was just an article. There was just an article in today's New York Times talking about these young girls who had had acid thrown in their face in Kandahar, Afghanistan, because they were going to school. So that's going to be partly what we talk about, the consequences of education. Greg Mortensen's on a tour. He's going to be in our town. Right now he's in snowy Minneapolis. Greg Mortensen, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter. Great to be with you.
That must have really struck home when you read that article about these young girls having acid thrown in the face because they wanted to attend school.
Yeah, actually, what's so amazing, though, is they actually came back to school. They said they're willing to die to go to school. This happened a few months ago. And what something that people in the U.S. aren't very aware of is the fact that today in Afghanistan there are 6.5 million children in school, 2 million are female. And in 2000, Peter, this is 8 years ago, at the height of the Taliban, there's only 800,000 kids in school. It's the singest, you know, most increase in modern history in any country in school enrollment. On the other hand, just as you were saying, their girls are targeted. Over 500 schools have been destroyed since 2007 by the Taliban, and primarily nearly all those schools are boys' schools. Girls' schools. They're not boys' schools. And I think the reason for that is the greatest fear of the Taliban. It's not the bullet, but it's a pen. And what they fear is if that girl grows up, gets an education, the value of education will go on in the community. So we're really, I started this 8 years before 9/11, but our primary focus is on educating girls.
Now, I said 60 schools. Somewhere, that's what I'm reading here, but isn't it a large?
We're actually up to 80, and we've got a couple dozen also underway. And then we also run another 50 schools. That are in very remote areas, in tents or in refugee areas. And what's not the building the school, that's the easy part. What's the really challenging part and also exciting is getting the education going, working for many, many years sometimes to convince people about girls' education. And girls' education, I've been doing this 15 years, but the more I do this, I'm really convinced, you know, we can drop bombs or hand out condoms or build roads or put in electricity. But if we don't educate the girl, the society won't change. And the things that happen, Peter, with girls' education, is number one, infant mortality drops. It's the kids who die at early age. One out of three children die before they join in many areas where we work. The population explosion drops. This takes about 20 years. Number three, the quality of health improves. And from my own perspective, when girls learn to read and write, they often write letters for their mothers. And it's the first time the mothers can communicate with their families because their maternal ties are severed when they get married. And something else that happens is when the kids come home from the marketplace, they have newspaper-wrapped vegetables or meat, the mother will unfold the newspaper. And probably one of the more profound things also is that when it's stated in the Quran, the Islamic holy book, that when someone goes on jihad, they have to get permission first from their mother. If a woman has an education, she's much likely to condone her son to get into violence or terrorism, and that happened. The primary recruiting grounds for the Taliban are in impoverished, illiterate society. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, all their mothers are uneducated, they are, but it is a fairly strong compelling reason for promoting education also.
Well, Greg Mortensen, your story reminds me to some extent of 7 years in Tibet about the pre-World War II man, the mountain climber, who
Heinrich.
There, what?
Heinrich.
Oh, yes, right. Which, I mean, that's a good comparison, at least I think so. So tell us just real briefly, because I want to get more into the nuts and bolts of the schools, but this was one of those epiphanies, and it happened on K3 or in that region where you almost lost your life in when? Was it 1993?
Yeah, it was in 1993. I grew up in Africa 15 years. My parents were, I'm Midwestern, Minnesota. I also have a lot of relatives and cousins in Michigan, the Detroit area. And I for 15 years, my father ended up building a hospital in Kilimanjaro, Tanzania. I came back to the States. I went into the military 4 days after high school. I joined the Army for 2 years, so I'm a military veteran. What led me to go to K2 in Pakistan is the death of my younger sister, Krista, in 92, who had severe epilepsy. She wanted to go to see Field of Dreams in Darzo, Iowa. Have you seen that baseball movie?
Sure.
And she packed her bags, but when she, my mother went to wake her up on July 23rd, 1992, she had died in her sleep.
Oh,
so,
boy.
So I decided at the time I had honor memory. I was a football player and also climbed mountains, so I decided I'm going to go climb a big bad mountain for my sister. So after the coming down, I stumbled in this village. I was befriended by the people, and I saw 84 children sitting in the dirt. I grew up in poverty, so I saw it when in Africa, but it was those children really touched my, really touched me, seeing them writing with sticks in the sand and asking for a school. So I had no clue how to fundraise, and so I came back to the States. I hand-typed 580 letters to, I didn't know how to use a computer back then. People say, in 94, you didn't know how to use a computer, but, you know, we all took our time, I guess. So I hand-typed these letters to movie stars, sports heroes, celebrities, and I only got one check back from Tom Brokaw for $100. And then I sold everything I owned. And it was actually my mother's, she's a principal at Westside Elementary School in River Falls, Wisconsin. I went there in 94, talked to the kids for a day, and a fourth grader named Jeffrey said, I have a piggy bank at home, and I'm going to help you. I didn't think anything of it, and 6 weeks later, they had raised 62,340 pennies. That's $623.
Sure.
It was the largest donation I'd ever had. And so the next 3 years, I worked very hard to get the school built, and it didn't go very well. Actually, I had a lot of failures, and what changed things around is one day an old village chief there, Haji, told me, he took my plumb line receipts and records, and he locked them up, and he said, you need to sit down, be quiet, and let us do the work. And what happened 6 weeks later, the school got built. And the real lesson there is that the community needed to be empowered and do the work itself. And that's one of my main, on a bigger scale, until recently, one of my main criticisms of the reconstruction of Afghanistan is that it was primarily centralized and deprovincialized. And you might be familiar with the Marshall Plan after World War II.
Sure.
It was primarily provincialized and decentralized. And the book I wrote, Three Cups of Tea means an old chief told me once, if you want to do business, you need three cups of tea. The first, you're a stranger. Second, a friend. And third, your family. Mm. And for a family, we're prepared to do anything, even die. You know, that's the kind of, you know, fake families in Detroit, the same thing. We all know about that.
Greg Mortensen is my guest, and he's the author of Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. We're talking about the school that he's helped facilitate in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And when I spoke to your publicist, I said, well, sure, send me the book. My Tai Chi teacher had been recommending it. And she has participated in funding a school in Afghanistan and has visited there. And I was surprised not to get Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time, but the Young Readers edition of Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Journey to Change the World, One Child at a Time, and another companion book, probably for even younger kids, called Listen to the Wind, the Story of Dr. Greg and Three Cups of Tea. And interestingly, about the Young Readers edition, it has an interview with your daughter, your 12-year-old daughter, Amira. Tell us, what was the idea behind having young people in children's edition of the book and your work?
Well, I'm not really a writer, and there was a lot of interest. So I finally wrote the adult book, and what happened is it's been a New York Times bestseller for 100 weeks. It's gotten a lot of interest from liberals and conservatives, people of all faiths. The military is very keen on it. It's mandatory reading for military officers going to counterintelligence training. General Petraeus, who's the CENTCOM commander, he read the book, and he told me that what he learned from it was three, I guess it's called bullet points. He's a military general. But we need to build relationships. We need to listen more. And we need to have respect. And what he's saying, that we're of service to other people. I thought it was a very interesting insight. But 57 universities had read it campus-wide, and there was also hundreds of high schools and junior highs. So what we decided to do is make this at a level that younger kids could do. And this all came about as Pennies for Peace program that we have. it's grown so much. It's gone from 300 now to 3,000 schools in the last 18 months, and we encourage kids to, they collect pennies. There's all these other math and cultural lessons, but they decide themselves what they want to do, and it can be anything, whether it's, you know, in Detroit, in your community, or nationwide, or internationally. And so this guy, there's hundreds of thousands of kids around the country picking up pennies, so off, you know, back of the pickup or...
Sure. Well, it's interesting that you've said you're not a writer, and this book, 2 million copies sold. People should know that you can get on the bestseller list of the New York Times selling like 150,000 copies. 2 million copies have been sold of Three Cups of Tea. This, as you said, nationwide effort called Pennies for Peace. 6,000 schools are going to be participating to build schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And last year, $900,000 in pennies was raised. This must have come as personally, like just, I don't know, shocking is the word, but at least surprising, eh?
Yeah, it's been shocking, but mostly it's so inspiring. What I see, the transformation, not only over there and the hope education gives, but kids here really want to make a difference. And I think we, as adults, we sometimes exude fear or we're kind of cynical or we say, you know, the world's going to fall apart. But I see these hundreds of thousands of kids around the country really want to make a difference. I think they've been affected. A lot of parents, siblings have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think people really want to make a difference. And as a veteran, I feel, you know, I have such deep respect for what the military is doing. And I have, you know, trying to also let the American public know that the military has now gone into these very volatile areas. They've deployed forward operating bases. And although they're exposed to more, you know, attacks, on the other hand, they're building relationships with the people and really putting responsibility on them. So there's been some really dramatic improvements in stabilizing areas. On the other hand, the Taliban are getting more aggressive. They're attacking more outposts. But I think overall, again, I think the key to peace and the success is based in education.
Well, and well that you've done, and the chronicling in Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Greg Mortensen, and he's going to be in the Detroit area. He'll be appearing on Sunday, January 25th at Berkeley High School, the auditorium, and it's sponsored by the Bookbeat. The Bookbeat usually has authors in their store. That's what, when authors appear, that's generally where they are. But this is going to be at least a 1,000-seat auditorium. Admission is free. And it's going to be 1 to 4 p.m. It's going to be an hour presentation by Greg and followed by a two-hour book signing. And it's something I would highly recommend attendance at. Let's go back to your experiences early on. When you first started building schools in Afghanistan, the Taliban was the government, correct?
Right. We were, at that point, we weren't building schools, but we were, say, discreetly helping teachers and running schools in refugee camps. But we didn't really have any problem. I think the real, we've only had one of our schools attacked by the Taliban, and incidentally, that school, 2 days later, the local commandant, which is like a local militia leader, I guess, you know, like a gang leader or whatever, he came in, killed two Taliban, and got rid of the other 15 because he had two daughters in school. And it's, you know, it's not, it's very difficult, it's very, say, tricky also, but overall, I find most people want their kids to go to school, including the girls, and these brave young girls in Kandahar who, it was, I don't know, a month or two ago, they had acid thrown on their faces, all of them came back to school last week, and the students inside were cheering when they came back inside, and they're, you know, they're at great risk now to be attacked. They're saying they're willing to even risk their life to get an education.
Well, it's quite a conundrum if you think about it. In 30,000 to 60,000 more American troops fighting in Afghanistan and seeing the level of civilian casualties that have already been experienced there is certainly going to heighten that. On the other hand, a reemergence of the Taliban government would just sink your projects and the idea of entering modernity. So it almost, and that's what's, I guess, so disheartening to me, I'm sorry to say, because your book, Three Cups of Tea, is filled with such optimism. It almost seems in many ways that that Afghanistan is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't.
Well, historically, The Afghan people have had invaders for 2,000 years. Not one of the people who come in have ever stayed too long, or they've been overthrown by, you know, local tribal people. It's got a long history of that. I think, you know, it's unfortunate that after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan, we supported a called Mujahideen, the freedom fighters there, that in 1989, we were, before that decade that Soviets were in Afghanistan, we were supplying about $1 billion a year in military aid to the freedom fighters. But from 89 to 90, we gave less than $1 million to go right directly to education. As a result of that, these extremist schools started popping out cause like popcorn everywhere. Kids were getting indoctrinated, very violent type of Islam. And it's easy to sometimes maybe just throw in the towel or say, well, it's not worth it. But when I see girls and mothers willing to risk their lives to go to school, and I also know, you know, see that the number of kids in school is down 8 times in 8 years, I think that we should do everything we can to support those people and help them out. And I was a little disheartened with Obama's proclamation about rapidly deploying 30,000 fresh troops into Afghanistan. I several times briefed special forces and other troops going to Afghanistan on my own, but I try and teach them about cultural awareness and understanding. And what the government or leaders are mainly talking about firepower, but if you talk to military leaders, what they say, well, we need more of there are military trainers to help build up their own military, their police force. They need more supplies. And again, the top party also, you can talk to any person in the military, it's about education.
Well, Greg Martin, you've had some experiences of your own. You've had death threats. You were actually kidnapped.
Yeah, back in 96, and I had yet to learn quite a bit, but I guess it's like sometimes you might not want to go to Detroit just anywhere, anytime, and unless you have somebody local bring you in there, and the same in the tribal areas. If you're going to an area, you ask for permission and become a guest of the tribal leader, the militia leader, then their hospitality is measured on how well they protect you. So I brazenly went into a new area. This is July 96, and ended up getting kidnapped by the Taliban for 8 days. And fortunately, I was released. And I think part of the result, after 3 days, I had a lot of, I got really depressed, and I visualized, you know, I thought, thinking, at any time they're going to take me outside and do me in or finish me off. But I then asked them to bring a I thought, you know, the only way to get out of here is I got to befriend my captors because there's no way I can escape. And so I asked them to bring a Quran, teach me about their faith. And then the sixth day I told them I had a son being born and I wanted to go home to see my firstborn son. My wife was 7 months pregnant and I ended up having a daughter, but that really, because in their culture, the firstborn son is life's greatest event. So I knew that that was one of the cultural things that they celebrate. It's huge, a celebration. That seemed to open up. And later on, they just found out that I was trying to set up, help them with school, so they ended up releasing me after 8 days.
Why they had kidnapped you, what base for, they thought they could get a ransom for you?
Well, I went back there, actually, after 2 years, and I found out, I was kidnapped. One for ransom, and also there was a dispute between two feuding clans, and I was held as a bartering chip between those two clans, and believe me.
That's great.
And this goes back, they've been fighting like that for centuries, let's say, often kidnap people. And I wouldn't advise anybody, though, unless you have an invitation or go with somebody who knows the people, don't just go wandering around.
Well, I have a better offer in that you can go hear you on Sunday, January 25th, and I'll give those details in a minute. I see we're running out of time. I also see that I reduced your book sales by about 300,000. So far, it's 2.3 million copies sold of Three Cups of Tea by Greg Martin. And one of the things I'd like to offer to our audience, there's, you know, tens of thousands of people listening. The auditorium only holds 1,000, so probably most people aren't going to be there. Just, I guess, the fortunate ones. We'll see you in person and experience your presentation. But if schools or parents want to get hooked up with, for instance, Pennies for Peace, how do they do that?
The website, Pennies for Peace, just spell it out like with forpac.com. And the book is threecupsoftea.com. And that goes to all our organizations and everything. And I also am looking forward to, I've been talking to people, so on my own, I'd love to come back to Detroit. I used to go spent time in Flint and Detroit. I actually had a girlfriend up there for a while when I was in Indiana. Also, when I was going out to Lansing and up Traverse City. So for me, it's really great to be coming again, and I look forward to also coming again this fall.
Well, we have two other books, two companion books. One is the Young Readers Edition, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Journey to Change the World, One Child at a Time. That's substitute child for the school in the adult version. It's got a foreword by primatologist Jane Goodall, which is excellent. That's published by Puffin. And also a younger child's version, Listen to the Wind. It's illustrated book, wonderful collages by Susan L. Roth. That's the story of Dr. Greg, who we're talking to right now, and Three Cups of Tea as well. What is there a message that you try to leave people with when people exit a Greg Mortensen talk and presentation? What are you hoping that they leave with?
Well, first of all, that anybody can make a difference. And I think when we focus on children, I think the real hope for the future is with our kids. And I have a quote in my bathroom mirror. I've had it for about 20 years. And it says, when your heart speaks, take good notes. I think sometimes we spend too much time trying to analyze and worry and plan and strategize, and sometimes the answer is right there in our heart. And I think working with tribal people, often they do things. Sometimes I say, why are you doing this? And they'll say, no, just because my heart says so. And I think that's something we could learn from them.
Well, the websites are penniesforpeace.com, and that's what your parents can get involved with, get your kids involved. The book, Three Cups of Tea.com. And also, if you want to get more information about the appearance of Greg Mortensen Sunday, January 25th, you can go to thebookbeat.com. Again, it's January 5th, Sunday, 1 to 4 p.m., Berkeley High School Auditorium on Catalpa Drive near Coolidge. Greg Mortensen, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you, Peter. I'm looking forward to coming to Detroit, and thanks so much.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Take it.
On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G.
Your new Apple iPhone 3G connects you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, look at the game.
Log on and listen worldwide at WRAF.com.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin clear breakthrough risk-free. People who are sick and tired of wasting money on acne products that just don't work. If that's you, it's a call. We're going to prove you can't make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of proactive solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. Find out how to get your risk-free 60-day trial calling 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription acne medicine and soothing spa-quality botanicals to create a powerful acne-fighting system. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put us to the test and we'll prove it. Get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now toll-free 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Is your credit score holding you back? Are you paying more for everything just because you don't have perfect credit? Well, it's not your fault. Credit card companies are doing everything they can to keep you in debt and never let you escape. But I got a system that can fix your credit score once and for all. And I'm going to send you a free tape showing you the power of my proven system today.
My credit score is 758. My wife and I are shouting for joy right now.
Hi, I'm Jeff Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My system doesn't just fix your credit score, it will permanently rebuild your credit status so it can never come back to haunt you again. It works no matter how bad your credit is or how much debt you have.
Our credit score was in the low 600s and now we're at 780.
You can wipe the slate clean once and for all. Call right now and I'll rush my free tape. For your free tape, call 1-800-337-1713. That's 1-800-337-1713. 1-800-337-1713.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Peter Werby here with you. Thanks for joining me. Last November 22nd, I interviewed Lamar Waldron. He and talk show host Tom Hartman have essentially written the definitive account of who killed John F. Kennedy in 1963. The latest book from Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman is Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination. And the first one was Ultimate Sacrifice. And the two of them, particularly through the work of Lamar, I don't mean to shortchange my friend Tom Hartman, but went definitively named the men in mafia who were behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So all of the Vincent Bugliosi contentions about it was Lee Harvey Oswald or all the other stuff, park all that. Read Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination. Lamar Waldron is joining us again this right the eve of the holiday of Martin Luther King's birthday, and we'll see how that ties in as well. Joining us in Atlanta is Lamar Waldron. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Great to be here, Peter.
So this is amazing. Right before we talked to you, sort of with a chuckle, said, well, we've solved both of the cases. I mean, that's a tall order. I mean, the JFK, how many pages are in all of that, those two books?
Well, those two books, the Associated Press put out an amazingly fair-minded review summary that's in a lot of newspapers. Actually, most of the newspapers in Canada, of course, newspapers in the U.S. are not as tuned in to this material, shall we say. So it's only in probably a few dozen newspapers in America. It's 1,700 pages for both books.
Wow, that's amazing. And why do you think it is? Most people have not read Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination, and Ultimate Sacrifice, as we have tens of millions of people, actually hundreds of millions of people in this country. Why do you think the skepticism of something that happened going on two generations ago is still present?
I'll actually detail that in Legacy of Secrecy, where one of the kind of subplots, not the main theme of Legacy of Secrecy, but one of the subplots, is looking how United States agencies, in particular the CIA, manipulate and influence the U.S. news media. They're only supposed to do that overseas, but they've actually been doing that, of course, since the 50s. And oddly enough, a name not unfamiliar to many listeners of a certain age, named E. Howard Hunt, was heavily involved in that effort going back to 1962. All through the 60s, and even not long before his little experience in Watergate. And
he was one of the men that that burglarized the Watergate office and led to the downfall of Richard Nixon.
That is totally correct. But, you know, the CIA has had a lot of influence on the news media. We reproduce in Legacy of Secrecy quotes from the uncensored 40-plus page document the CIA issued in January of 1967 on how to influence how to destroy, basically, critics of the Warren Report. And we describe why the CIA was doing that, how they did that. So there's no massive conspiracy to keep people from knowing about the JFK assassination, but the U.S. news media, the mainstream media, has been sensitized to this. And frankly, I had reporters tell me, look, this is a tough subject. I can't get this past my editor. But, cracks in the wall are starting to appear. CNN did a good piece. Sure, they had to have Vincent Bugliosi on in addition to me last week. But, you know, they showed the confession that the New Orleans godfather, Carlos Marcello, made to assassinating JFK to an FBI informant. Liz Smith's been tremendous. She did two fantastic articles last week. I mentioned the AP review of Legacy of Secrecy. And there's other news in the works. So things are gradually starting to come out because the documentation, and people should know this for everything Tom and I write about Legacy of Secrecy and Ultimate Sacrifice, it's just so overwhelming. All of the documents come from the National Archives. We talked with more than two dozen associates of John and Robert Kennedy. And they're the ones who really set me on this path, Tom and I, together originally 20 years ago. So, the CIA has this motto, the truth shall make you free. They don't always follow that, but I think that is true. So the more we can get the information out there, because it has so much relevance today when we're, when it's Martin Luther King's birthday and we're on the eve of Obama's inauguration. And Obama embodies so much of the hope that we all felt for John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King in the 1960s. And we never want to have to go through those three tragedies again. But, it's said those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And I have to say, in the lead up to Obama's election, we saw some of the same type of racist rhetoric being used against him. There were racist threats, not just against his supporters, but against Obama. And in fact, two of the actual assassination plots against Obama are shockingly similar to plots I write about in Legacy of Secrecy were directed at both Martin Luther King and earlier against John F. Kennedy. So getting all the truth out about who really killed Dr. Martin Luther King and why it was covered up so long and why material was withheld from Congress, why the King assassination files are being withheld till the year 2029, which is ridiculous. So we need to get the word out, and that's what I'm here for today.
Well, I appreciate that, Lamar Waldron. You know, though, the, some of the other, we don't have a final court, so there's no way to, I mean, your book certainly contains definitive evidence. People can say almost anything, and they have over years, sometimes, usually with the best of intentions, with available information. You and Air America host Tom Hartman have had access to files that weren't previously available. But if it was the mob, well, I mean, I'm sorry, I will not in those terms. Since it was the mob who carried out the hit on JFK, that's a one-off. In other words, there's not, like other people have said in the past, that there's this secret government whose tentacles go, you know, have reached through American governmental processes for the last 50 or 60 years. So there isn't a continuity, or is there?
Well, what we have to realize is, you know, the world isn't black and white, it's gray. And there is a point where the mafia meets a big business, and that's just a fact, and politics. And a guy by the name of Peter L. Scott has been writing about that for the past almost, I think, 35 years. And people, some people, and Mark Crispin Miller would advise people to read what he wrote. He wrote a good piece about this just a few weeks ago. And he's a very astute author and wrote about, you know, the stolen elections and how media control consolidation is bad for America. But, you know, he said people sometimes like to say, well, there's no point in trying for political change in America because they'll just shoot whoever we put up. They shot JFK, they shot Martin Luther King, they shot Bobby Kennedy. So let's just give up. Let's snipe and complain and not actually try to get progressive candidates elected. You know, but that game has changed. Now with Obama, who against all odds, in a tremendously stacked deck, is going to be inaugurated. So, while there's not a shadow government, sure there are influence and there are huge corporations, but organized crime was a major factor in controlling, not controlling, but influencing politicians going back decades, not just the 60s. So I find that a lot of authors like to write about the shadow government, they pretty much ignore the mafia's role in all of this, you know, and that goes from you know, even people like Richard Nixon, who was from the mafia with the start and tried to use the mafia to win the 60 election by basically having the CIA hire them to assassinate Fidel, and then his ties to mafia are really what brought him down during Watergate, as we write about in Legacy of Secrecy. So the mafia has had a big influence, and oddly enough, it's the three assassinations that concern people the most from the 60s, JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, where the mafia, including just a handful of figures, played key roles. What's important for people to understand is they were able to do that in a way that forced government to cover up. People often said, who like to talk about the shadow government and the shadowy generals and the CIA and FBI and Lyndon Johnson killed JFK, they say, well, it controlled the cover-up and you'll see who did the crime.
Mm-hmm.
But as we documented in Ultimate Sacrifice and document much more in Legacy of Secrecy, that's simply not true because Bobby Kennedy controlled an awful lot of the cover-up after his brother's death. And he certainly didn't kill him. In fact, as we show in both books, the cover-up was in the works before JFK was even killed, and Bobby Kennedy was directing it. So there's so much of the secrecy, and as we've talked for, a lot of it centered around Cuba. And basically, that's what Legacy Secrecy is about. It documents how the tragedies that resulted from all that government secrecy surrounding JFK's assassination, how it pretty much led directly to the assassination of Martin Luther King and to the 45-year impasse between the U.S. and Cuba. You know, we've been frozen in that since JFK was killed. And it impacts things today, range from Obama's security to the prosecution of Dick Cheney for crimes, going back to the 70s when he's out of office.
Legacy of Secrecy is the book, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination, and it takes up the Martin Luther King assassination as we speak on the eve of Dr. King's birthday. The website is legacyofsecrecy.com. It's published by Counterpoint. My guest is co-author Lamar Waldron. And, dear listener, if you are like me, almost every sentence that Lamar Waldron says, you want to ask another question. And if I do that, we need a 9.5-hour show or read the book. So that's your cue. It's available at all bookstores and certainly online as well. And I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. But let's jump ahead to the Martin Luther King assassination, April 4th, 1968. That seems to be, to most people, slam dunk. If people even remember, it was a man named James Earl Ray. He was a racist southerner, shot him, got caught, confessed and end of story. How does this tie in your book into the JFK assassination?
Well, what many people don't remember is that in the late 1970s, Congress investigated the assassinations of JFK and Martin Luther King. They concluded that a conspiracy had killed JFK, and they pinpointed two people in particular. One person was Carlos Marzullo, the godfather who controlled Louisiana and Texas, and his influence stretched from Memphis to Florida, where his allies were in power. And they said that Marzullo had the motive, means, and opportunity to kill JFK. They couldn't figure out exactly how he did it, because so much information was held about Marcello by the FBI and the CIA from Congress. The second congressional committee, headed by Congressman Lewis Stokes, concluded that while James Earl Ray had killed Martin Luther King, he had likely been paid to do it, because he wasn't a white supremacist, he wasn't a Klan member, he was a petty criminal, a lifelong criminal. So someone had paid him to do it. Again, they couldn't say exactly who, because so much material was withheld. But Tom able to do with legacy of secrecy is go back to the JFK assassination, and what we do there is literally name the people who confess, and there's evidence back up their confessions. You have Carlos Marcello's uncensored confession to JFK's murder. There was also a person, a white supremacist from Georgia named Joseph Miltier, who was on Miami police informant tape 2 weeks before Dallas saying that JFK was going to be shot with a rifle from a tall building. Okay. Now, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director at that time, one of the most powerful in America, botched both of those investigations, both before JFK's murder and after. He'd gotten a few warnings, full of many, you know, thousands of pages of mafia so complaining about JFK and war against them prior to JFK's murder. Hoover botched the investigation of this godfather Marcello, who was the driving force behind JFK's murder. Hoover also botched the investigation of Georgia white supremacist Joseph Miltier, who was investigated right before JFK's death, then JFK died. If you're J. Edgar Hoover, you cannot allow it to come out that you had a white supremacist from Georgia talking on tape about JFK being shot from the building of a high-powered rifle, and then you botched an investigation and JFK was shot from the building of a high-powered rifle. You can never allow it to come out. For Carlos Marcello, not only did he have a couple of threats beforehand, one in particular, but in the weeks after JFK's murder, a dozen associates of Carlos Marcello were interviewed or arrested by law enforcement, and yet you will not find Carlos Marcello's name anywhere in the Warren Report. So Hoover had a lot cover up about Marcello, the driving force, and this white supremacist who played a small role in JFK's murder. Well, now let's flash ahead to 1968. Joseph Miltier, white supremacist from Georgia, frequently visits Atlanta, is a driving force behind the assassination of Martin Luther King. He and his associates every Friday are collecting money from Atlanta's highest paid factory workers to fight civil rights. If you're a regular contributor and you contribute a substantial sum every Friday on payday, you're basically like pulled aside and whispered. They say, well, this money is just going to fight civil rights, you know. This is going for a fund to kill Martin Luther King. And it was supposed to make you feel like you were part of a little private group, up your contributions, make sure you kept contributing. However, after a few years of that, these racist contributors were like, hey, you know, King's still here. Nobody's even trying to take a shot at him. A lot of people don't realize for a lot of unsolved civil rights killings in 66, 67, 68, even places like Atlanta, but nobody was taking shots at Martin Luther King. So Miltier faced a problem because he and his three partners here in Atlanta were using that money to buy up undeveloped mountain land in North Carolina. And so you had this little racist group in Atlanta bilking thousands of other racist factory workers are in Atlanta. But, you know, those racist factory workers, the factory in particular they operated from, the Lakewood General Motors plant here in Atlanta, where I worked briefly in college, that was a particular hotbed of racism. A former Klan leader had worked there. It was center for what was called blockbusting back in the old days, where real estate firms would target a neighborhood for rapid transition. And so it was just really, you had a lot of resentful people. Most of the people at that General Motors plant were great, good, honest, decent people. But you had a minority that weren't. They were racist contributors.
And how is this documented, this information?
Well, we'll get to that in
okay.
just a moment.
Go ahead, Lamar.
And because I heard about the story from informants when I worked there years ago, and it was able to backtrack this. I mean, I was working there in 1973, not long after this happened, and some of these people that had contributed or who knew about some of this, frankly, felt guilty about it. And so what Miltier had to do, and here's where we get into things that are documented from congressional files and files withheld from Congress, Miltier tried to find someone to take a shot at Martin Luther King. Did not have to be an experienced hitman because he just needed someone to make the attempt that he claimed credit for. And they made attempts to find an experienced criminal who would know to keep their mouth shut. And this is documented by congressional investigators. But they couldn't. I mean, there's like a briefcase offered a couple of house payments here now, a briefcase of $50,000, but couldn't do that. Miltier was tied in closely with the Klan, with J.B. Stoner, with all your mainline racist groups, including the very respectful ones, the Citizen Council, the Klan and Suits and Ties. But he didn't want to use people from those organizations because that could be traced back to him. Didn't even want to kill Martin Luther King in Atlanta because his partners lived in Atlanta. He frequently visited Atlanta, and that they were worried that would trigger race riots. So what Miltier did, and this is from Justice Department file that was withheld from Congressman Stokes, but is now available in Quote and Legacy of Secrecy for the first time. Joseph Miltier and a small group of white racists turned to his old friend from 1963, Carlos Marcello. And according to this Justice Department file, this is the Justice Department, not me saying this, the Mafia, in particular Carlos Marcello, brokered the assassination contract for an amount between $200,000 and $300,000, which would be more than $1 million today. And Marcello passed the contract off to one of his lieutenants. Now, Marcello did not accept the contract. He merely brokered it. He had one or two meetings and made $1 million for passing off to one of his lieutenants, who would make far less, and then it gets passed down the line. James Earl Ray, now this is from congressional files, but see, they were missing a key piece, was a low-level heroin runner for Carlos Marcello's drug organization. And here's where Michigan comes into the story. So James Earl Ray, black criminal, ties to organized crime going back to the 50s, prison drug dealer, escapes from prison in the spring of 1967. First goes to Chicago. Then he winds up, gets a connection, winds up going up through Michigan into Canada, where he becomes a heroin smuggler, running heroin across the border from Canada into Michigan. And he's doing that in the summer of 1967.
Lamar, we have 3 minutes left, so I just that's why Legacy of Secrecy, the Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination, is something that has to be read. It is so replete with the information and the details, and as it is, Lamar Waldron, the co-author, is summarizing it. So go ahead.
Exactly. There's 250 pages about King's assassination, so long story short is James Earl Ray becomes the assassin. He winds up fulfilling the contract. And Legacy of Secrecy explains for the first time why James Earl Ray, after killing King in Memphis and fleeing to Canada, makes a 450-mile detour to Atlanta, where he calls Miltier's associate at the auto plant. Ray abandons his car in Atlanta, his getaway car. The whole country's looking for 8 blocks from Dr. King's office and church. People have wondered, what the heck is going on with that? Well, that was halfway between the auto plant and his rooming house. Ray abandons his car 3 miles from the rooming house. Joseph Miltier, the white supremacist associate of Carlos Marcello, admits to one of his friends he was there when Ray abandoned his car. Miltier helped Ray get to the rooming house, to the bus station, and then this penny-ante criminal, James Earl Ray, goes to Canada, to England, to Portugal, back to England, where he's finally caught. So that
why was he traveling? Would he ever say why he traveled to all these places just on the lamp?
He can never explain that. But of course, when you have the white supremacist money and you're part of this international drug heroin network of Carlos Marcello, you know, that's not that difficult. You're right. For an ordinary penny criminal, it's ridiculous. And by the way, there are many people that think that J. Edgar Hoover killed Martin Luther King because he did all these horrible things to target King. He didn't, because that was a horrible embarrassment to the FBI for the most wanted man in the world to be on the run for 2 months.
James Earl Ray, at the end of his life in prison, he was sentenced to life in prison, and he recanted, did he?
Well, he always maintained his innocence, and that was part of the problem. People either had to say, well, James Earl Ray was completely innocent, like his defense attorneys and many authors, or he was guilty alone and no one paid him. We kind of have the truth that's in the middle from government files. Here's how it's relevant today, because I saw Michael Chertoff, Homeland Security Director, on TV the other day saying, well, the biggest threat Obama faces during his inauguration is from a lone nut, is from a lone racist gunman. And, of course, he's doing that based on the conventional view of history, lone nut Oswald, lone nut James Earl Ray. That's just not correct. We need to get the real information out there because, you know, the big threat to Obama are from, you know, small, well-financed racist groups who've had their fears stoked by, frankly, politicians who exploit racist fears. It just happened in the 60s. The wording is different today, but a lot of that hatred and racism is still around.
Actually, you kind of anticipated my last question, or one of my last ones. At least, do you fear for Obama in a particular manner that wouldn't for, say, if John How quickly we forget, right?
Well,
McCain,
you,
John McCain. Yeah. In other words, do you fear for Obama in a particular manner?
As a native Georgian and as someone who worked at that Lakewood auto plant, and I know, you know, most people in the South, most white male in the South are not racist, but we have a sizable minority that are. And as long as we have politicians, you know, in the 60s we had Lester Maddox and George Wallace soaking racism, frankly, to line their own pockets and get political power. You have politicians, especially, I hate to say it, some here in Georgia today, doing the same thing. So until America comes to grip with the racism and let these politicians and big corporations stoke racism for their own gain, yeah, I worry about it a lot, because you have a lot of angry people out there, and they've been convinced that liberals and Hollywood are behind the new Republican depression we're facing. And that anger can get channeled. So, you know, again, the truth really will, you know, really will set you free. And so we need to get all the facts out there. And I can close by saying that, you know, these King files are locked away. The King assassination files until 2029. And that simply shouldn't be the case. I've talked to the director of Congressional Investigations, Robert Blakey. He says that shouldn't be the case. A million JFK assassination records have still not been released, even though there's a 1992 law that requires their release.
Well, so, there's an amazing amount of that still that has been released. The Legacy of Secrecy, the brand new book, the subtitle Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination, which goes on to the Martin Luther King assassination as well. It's written by Lamar Waldron with Air America host Tom Hartman. And you can go to legacyofsecrecy.com. It's published by Counterpoint. You can go to my website as well, where there will be a link, peterwerby.com. Lamar Waldron, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thank you so much. And again, people listening, if you want to see those files, tell your congressperson or senator to do something about it.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Troy.
101 WRIF, IFFC Max. Bring the maximum Super Bowl bass to your dad. Keep your deal locked to Rip to score a committed Super Bowl 43 football. Your reporter will score the Grab Rocks. WRIF Party has your place with big game, including lots of ice cold FC Max, 40-inch flat screen TV with surround sound, and PlayStation 3 with Madden 2009 for you to keep. It's the maximum Super Bowl bash.
Listen and win.
IFFC Max. Maximum taste, maximum energy, zero calories, and 101 WRIF.
Are you in trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA, 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again, too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help get you out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Attention! Hydroeyes is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles, bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are now eligible to try Hydralyze free. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away. Watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience a free trial Hydralyze. For your free trial, call this number today. 1-800-505-7931. 1-800-505-7931.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back?
We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronic Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Now hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased there's... So I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronix is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Your credit card debt's getting out of control. You had trouble making the monthly minimums. Sound familiar? You have to do something, but what? Well, you don't have to file for bankruptcy. Mortgage brokers want you to put up your family home to pay off credit card debts. Problem is that more often than not, you find yourself using credit cards again. Only this time there's no equity left in your home, and you have a whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. For Credit Card Relief, we help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years, and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. An attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free. And the relief is real.
Call 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. 1-866-290-8282.
Back. The Rock.
101.
WRIF.
The Riff.